All right, we'll bring Senate Finance to order. Today is April 9th, Tuesday, about 9:10. With us thus far is Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Bishop.
Morning.
And Vice Chair Fairclough. So we have a quorum to conduct business this time of year. Appreciate the flexibility. We're going to change the schedule a little bit. House Bill 30 will not be taken up this morning. And Senate Bill 96, oil and gas lease sale, which was on the schedule for yesterday, we'll wait for the House bill to come over on that one. House Bill 198. So when that arrives, then we'll take that back up. So today we'll just be taking up some House bills. House Bill 94, Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges. House Bill 84, Military Training Credit. House Bill 99, Extend Minerals Commission. House Bill 153, Naming the Walter Hickel Parkway. And House Bill 56, Passenger Vehicle Rental Tax. I think most of these bills are fairly self-explanatory, so we'll just see how far we can get this morning. Is there anything to come before the committee before we get started? Okay, seeing none, then let's go right to House Bill 94, Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges. And see, it looks like, do you have a motion on that one, Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 94, Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges, version 28LS047. Let me repeat that, 28-LS0407/N.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Senator Kelly. I'll object for purposes of this discussion. We do have Representative Isaacson here. Welcome.
Thank you.
And then we do have the co-chair of finance staff here as well. Welcome, Daryl. So, yeah, if you could, if you guys could explain the changes and introduce us to the bill, the floor is yours, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I'm told that you hear only the most important bills this late in the session, so I appreciate you hearing House Bill 94. Conn and Nellie Miller were some of the early settlers of North Pole, and looking around this table, I don't have to tell you much about them. They are the parents of Terry Miller, for whom the building across the way is named, and Mike Miller, who has served in this body. Those two brothers were also the only two brothers that have ever served as Senate presidents as siblings. So it's amazing. They were two of the three children. Merry Christmas Miller is still in North Pole helping with the Santa Claus house. Nellie was one of 15 children. She was raised in Idaho Springs, Colorado, and married Conn in 1938 at the age of 15. And like many Alaska pioneers, Nellie and Conn moved to Alaska in 1950 with only $1.40 in their pocket, seeking a new beginning with their small family. They first built, they built their first business, a clothing store in Fairbanks, and Conn used to travel to rural communities to sell his wares. And when he traveled, he often donned a red crushed velvet Santa suit as part of the stock that the couple had brought forth from a previous business. And as they built up their store in North Pole in 1952, a child of a customer from Northway asked Conn if he was building a house for Santa Claus, and the name stuck. They're the reason why North Pole is really on the map today in many ways. Conn brought the paperwork that incorporated the city of North Pole to Juneau in 1952, and the city was incorporated January 16th of 1953. They are in many ways the epitome of the North Pole spirit. They're the reason why we have the theme where the spirit of North Pole or spirit of Christmas lives year-round. It's one of the reasons why, as mayor, I got in the habit of always wearing a Christmas-themed tie and continue to this day, because my constituents will ask me why I'm not wearing it when I don't have it on. So Christmas is a big part of North Pole, and we owe that to the original Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus. So this bill would allow the bridges over the Chena Flood Channel to be renamed from their undistinguishable names. The North Brown Bridge, number 1364, will have the distinguished name of Nellie, the original Mrs. Claus Miller Bridge, and the Southbound Bridge, 1866, will be redesignated as the Con and the original Santa Claus Miller Bridge. So that's my portion. Daryl from Representative Stoltz can explain the addition, which I wholeheartedly support, designating the Lowell J. Ray Memorial Corridor in Wasilla.
Representative Isaacson,
yes, sir.
I objected to the CS to just see what the differences were. Did you explain that and I missed it?
The difference is on this one, thank you, and I apologize. The title has been changed to accommodate both the Lowell J. Memorial Corridor and Senate Transportation. Senator Fairclough mentioned that it might be good if we designated Con and Nellie by their cultural moniker, Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus, and we thought that was a great idea, and checked with DOT, and that's totally doable. So that's the basis for the change.
Okay, very good. I'll remove my objection, so we'll have the CS before us. Daryl, if you could, put your name on the record, please. I don't even think I know your last name, Daryl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Daryl Brees, staff Representative Bill Stoltz. Representative Stoltz apologizes he can't be here himself to address this committee on this matter. He's working on an oil tax bill over in House Finance. The change to the bill relating to our constituents is naming a portion of East Blue Lupine Drive in Wasilla the Lowell J. Ray Memorial Corridor. Not many people know who Lowell Ray is, not quite as famous as the Millers, but his service to the country and to the community is admirable. 16 years in the Navy, 10 years in the Air Force, 20 years as a civil servant working for the Defense Department, made improvements to the Dew Line radar system, serving Alaska and Canada during the Cold War that extended the life of the radar system for an additional 12 years. Defense Department estimated it saved an approximate $12 million per radar station for the minor technical improvement that he made. His knowledge of that system led him to instruct allies in Germany, Britain, Canada, several other European countries in how to improve and enhance their system as well, which was similar to ours. The primary reason that we're bringing forward the naming for this section of road is DOT, when they were making improvements to the Parks Highway through Wasilla and through the purchase agreement of the property for right-of-way, made a promise to the Ray family, to Lowell's son Ken and his wife Kim, that they would name this a section of road on the Ferns Road, which eventually became named Blue Lupine, after his father. The road was subsequently named Blue Lupine. DOT dropped the ball and left it without going forward with the promise and keeping their commitment to the family to name the road. And we're bringing that forward today just to fulfill the promise that the state made to this family to name the road after Mr. Ray, both in recognition of his service to the country and to the community. He was active in many fraternal organizations and community organizations as well while he was living in the Wasilla area. So the change is to name the section of Blue Lupine Drive from Higher Road to Hay Street, which is a little under a mile, as the Lowell J. Ray Memorial Corridor, in honor of in keeping the promise the state made, and also in honor of this man's nearly 40 plus years of service to the country during the Cold War.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Daryl. And I apologize, I haven't read the total file here. This section of the road is in Wasilla, or where is this?
It's not actually in the city of Wasilla proper. It's kind of in between Palmer and Wasilla along the Parks Highway.
Okay. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darrell, will there be any need for, are there homes adjacent to the corridor?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, yes, there are homes adjacent to the corridor, but in speaking with Commissioner Kemp, by naming this small section a corridor, it doesn't actually change the name of the road. It just identifies this section as the Lowell J. Rigg corridor, and the addresses for the homes will still be on East Blue Pine Drive.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Dunleavy, I want to welcome you to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. Briefly through the chair, just a comment that this road and corridor are in my district. It's an access road off the parks. It's got some businesses, some homes on it.
Do you support this?
Sure.
Just want to make sure it's in your district. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Don't see any additional questions. We do have DOT online if there's something. Senator Bishop, yes, please.
I just have a comment. I fully support the naming of the bridge, of the signs that you're putting out here for the bridge. Not on this one, on the road sign. But my point being is just a comment. If DOT's listening, a promise made is a debt unpaid. And if we promise this sign, I just wondered if you got any loose change laying around from the contract when you did the road that you could put the signs up with a zero physical note. That's all.
That question was for DOT or?
Just a comment. Who's listening? That's all.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay. Well, speaking of the, I have no one signed up to testify on this, correct? Okay. So we'll go ahead and close public testimony unless there's somebody here yet in Juneau. Seeing no one. The fiscal note, there is a small fiscal note on both, primarily because it costs money to put up signs. So I think that's self-explanatory.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Fairclough?
Brief at ease.
Sure. Brief at ease. All right, we're back. Mr. Thomas with the Alaska DOT, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am here.
Okay. There was a comment made that, and I wasn't aware of this, that DOT suggested the sign?
Through the chair, DOT doesn't have the power to memorialize highways. That's a legislative purview. So the question about what the project effort was, there was an effort to go to the Matsu Borough and see how street addressing would be affected and emergency response. And the department did ask to rename the road in terms of the green signs that go on top of stop signs. And the choice rests with the borough on how they would like to redo their street addressing affecting people's mail delivery and emergency response, and East Blue Lupin was chosen instead. So we deferred to the borough on that. Now, I think memorializing is another avenue which the department did speak with the legislature, and that's why this is before us. So I wouldn't say we left this issue unaddressed. We just pursued it the only way we have authority, which is with green signs above stop signs with the borough, and then the authority to memorialize it lies with the legislature.
Well, I appreciate that. I guess the question is, do you have the $10,000 to put up the signs in your budget?
No, that project has long been built, and so now there's no project in the area.
Okay.
To the chair, if I may add one more comment on the Richardson Highway memorializing, a very minor note. In the analysis, it says the sign would be white letters on a blue background, and there might have been some confusion over the national manual that guides these, but the condition given to us federally is a brown background, and you'll see that commonly on most of the memorial signs we do these days.
Okay. Very good. Additional questions for Mr. Thomas? Okay. Thank you, for joining us, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not going to wrestle over $10,000 here. So let's, Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 94, the Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges, 28-LS0407/N, I have a hard time reading, from committee with fiscal notes and attached recommendations.
Okay, any objections? Seeing none, bill moves out of committee. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this morning.
Did we need a time change?
Yeah. Okay, let's go on now to House Bill 84. This is Representative Sadler, and if you want to bring up your trusty staff, you're welcome. Ms. Skipper. And let's see. This is the military training credit temporary license. And we've not heard this bill before, so Representative Sadler, if you could put your name on the record for us, please, and tell us what your bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12. Is that good on the mic there? Not too close? Not too far?
I think you sound okay.
Very good. Mr. Chairman and members, the goal of House Bill 84 is to help separating service members transition quickly and effectively into the civilian workforce. Each year, about 1,200 service members separate from service in Alaska and return home. And while in service, Americans in uniform receive world-class training, education, and experience. These are assets that should not be lost to them or our communities as they transition back to civilian careers. HB 84 asks the Division of Professional Licensing, the University of Alaska, and the Department of Labor to evaluate military training and education. And where appropriate, it directs them to assign civilian credit without compromising current licensing standards. Now, service members can often experience delays and lost opportunities qualifying for licenses and academic credit, even though they have applicable training and experience that should qualify them. This legislation would make it more likely that veterans in Alaska can get jobs and advance their civilian careers by accelerating that licensing process and the process of getting educational credit. Currently, we've got force reductions, significant budget cuts, and now the sequestration are going to mean even more veterans will be seeking civilian jobs. 19 states so far have enacted legislation similar to this as of last July, and about 30 states are considering similar legislation this year. Mr. Chairman, I think we have an obligation to find ways to give our veterans every opportunity to leverage their military experience into academic credit, job certification, or vocational training credits. Bills like House Bill 84 make that happen to everybody's benefit, and I appreciate your hearing the bill, and I'm glad to answer any questions. We have a couple people online, I believe, to testify on this as well, sir.
Great. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Questions from committee members? Okay. Very good. Senator Hoffman? No? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. We do have a couple people online here, it looks like. And we do have some folks in the audience available for questions. Don Haberger and Greg Cashin are both here. So Mark Sansushi, is that pretty close with the department?
Yes. Good. Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Mark Sansushi. I am the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest. I'm calling in to express Department of Defense's gratitude and support for Representative Sadler's effort to provide military members and new veterans academic and occupational license credit for their training. In many cases, this training has already been paid for by all of us paying our federal tax dollars, and any effort to give veterans credit where credit is due is most appreciated. Also, we support the effort with the 2014 effective date that's been negotiated and zeroes out the fiscal note, most importantly. And so with that, just want to express our gratitude for you taking this up, and I stand for any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Don't see any questions, so I do appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's see. Jeff Selby, I think he is just available for questions, though, I believe. Okay?
I got a comment.
Yes, Senator Bishop, go ahead, please.
This is for Jeff Selby in the Department of Labor. Under the sponsor's bill, under Section 4, adds a new subsection to include the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Shall implement a statewide policy that requires vocational training center to accept academic credit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just as a point of reference, Jeff, in the department, you might want to reach out to John Hockla or any of the JATCs who already accept military records on their DD-214s for application to apprenticeship programs. So they've got some track record already. So just as a point of not point of order, but just point of reference as you're drafting this section.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Additional questions, comments? Questions, comments, criticism, whatever. Okay. Don't see zero fiscal note. That's all good. So I think we're ready, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 84, Military Training Credit and Temporary License Bill, version U from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Can we hold up on that? Just say, I don't know if I officially closed public testimony. Was there anybody else? Okay. Well, public testimony is closed. Did you have something else, Senator Fairclough?
I just wanted to make sure that we knew that there were multiple zero fiscal notes.
Yeah. Many fiscal notes, but they're all zero. Okay. So, Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like to say for the record that a lot of the initial work on this was done by Representative Bill Thomas of Haynes. He was the chair of the Veterans Caucus and did a lot of good work in this last session. I just want to give credit where credit's due.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll remove my objection to your motion. Any other objections to moving the bill out of committee? Okay, I'll object. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see fiscal notes 1, 2, 3, and 5 that are all zero. Can anyone tell me where 4 is at? Just to make sure it's a zero. 5 replace 4. Thank you very much. Thank you. Fiscal notes.
Okay. I'll remove my objection again. Is there any other objections to moving this bill out of committee? Seeing none, bill moves out of committee.
Thank you, sir.
Sign it last sheet. Okay, we're back. The next bill before us is the extending the Minerals Commission. Again, Representative Sadler, and then also Trevor is with Representative, or Mr. Fulton is with Mr. Sadler. So if you could, again, put yourself on the record, both of you, and then introduce us to the bill.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be back before you so soon. This is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12, for the record. Before you have House Bill 99 to extend the Alaska Minerals Commission. Appreciate the chance to present this as well. House Bill 99 helps ensure the growth and sustainability of a vital sector of our Alaskan economy, the minerals development and mining sector. It does this by extending the Alaska Minerals Commission for an additional 10 years. The Alaska Minerals Commission was established by the legislature in 1986 and has been since reauthorized four times. It's responsible for identifying roadblocks to mineral development in our state and for making recommendations to the governor and legislature on how to clear them. The commission meets three times a year in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and in Juneau when commissioners deliver their annual report to the Capitol during their first 10 days of session. Since its last reauthorization in 2003, the Minerals Commission has made several key recommendations which the legislature has since implemented or is currently working to put into place. These include, but aren't limited to, reforming the state's permitting process to make permitting more timely and efficient, funding infrastructure development under the Roads to Resources program, and asserting and defending public access to roads, trails, and navigable waters. The Commission has proven and, if you look at the fiscal note, a rather notably affordable voice for an important sector of Alaska's economy. Mining employs 4,500 Alaskans and provides more than $600 million in direct and indirect payroll. It provides jobs and revenues for local governments in rural areas of the state that benefit from them definitely. The bill started off as a simple extension, but now provides for three-year terms and a limit of two consecutive terms. It also provides for the annual election of a chair and a vice chair. I appreciate your time and would be glad to answer questions. We have a member or two of the commission online to answer questions as well.
Okay, very good. Yep, we have Bill Jeffries with the Alaska Minerals Commission and Stephen Trimble also with the Alaska Minerals Commission. And Lorraine Palmer, is that right? Here? Okay. Very good. Questions for the sponsor? I guess I'll start out. When was the last time this commission was audited?
To my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if it's been audited. There has not been a request made of it for an audit.
And let's see, we're asking for a 10-year sunset?
Yes, sir.
Is that normal? Is that what you said, that it's normally 10 years?
It's had a couple of five-year extensions and one 10-year extension, and I think the thought was that it's doing good work and that has been re-upped a number of times, so let's just give it a longer term period.
Okay. Other questions? Great. Don't see any questions. Public testimony. No one signed up? Okay. We're on the, it's the House Bill 99, the Minerals Commission. Okay, thank you, Mr. Sadler. I think, Representative Sadler, I think I will ask the Chris, our auditor, to come up for a minute or two.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, representing the Division of Legislative Audit.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Curtis.
Thank you.
The co-chair is not laughing at you.
I'm not laughing. I'm sorry.
So are you okay with this 10-year extension?
Our division has no opinion because we have not done an audit. This is one of those entities that is not subject to mandatory audits. Similar to the Alaska, the ARDRs, the Alaska Regional Development that we had discussed during the session, an extension comes up and it does not trigger an audit because it's not part of our audit statutes.
Okay, that makes sense. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. To the sponsor, can you tell me what the state is currently spending on this commission?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, pardon me. The fiscal note for this extension is about $13,000 a year.
So that's you believe that's the total amount that we expend on?
I believe so. That includes travel for the meetings, the cost of printing the annual report, and what minimal staff support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And this report is available to the public, is that correct?
Yes, sir. It's I believe printed copies were distributed earlier this session, and of course the PDF version is available online through the department's website.
Okay, very good. All right, additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, I guess that explains the need for the fiscal note. Any questions on the fiscal note? Looks like it's $13,000 a year. Seeing none? All right, Senator Kelly.
Gabby little group today, aren't we?
Yeah. All right.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I would move from Committee CS for House Bill Number 99, Resources, Version 28-LS0430/N, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves out of committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're going to bring the Senate Finance back to order. The next bill before us, House Bill 153, naming Walter J. Hickle Parkway. We do have the representative here, representing Lynn, and his staff, Forrest Wolf. And so with that, Representative Lynn, if you could introduce the bill to us. And the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Representative Bob Lynn, representing House District 23 in South Anchorage. HB 153 would designate a 7.5-mile portion of the current Minnesota Drive from 15th Street down to New Seward as the Walter J. Hickle Parkway. It involves only two large brown road signs, similar to the ones that are posted on other historic roads or nearby parks. Wally Hickle, of course, is no stranger to members of this body or most any other Alaskan. He arrived in Alaska with only 37 cents in his pocket. He was a boxer, and he worked, actually fought his way up to United States Secretary of the Interior and twice served as governor of our great state of Alaska. Governor Hickle pushed hard to open Prudhoe Bay for oil development and oversaw the permitting process for the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, through which flows the lifeblood of revenue to our state. For these and many other reasons, we believe it's most appropriate to designate a portion of Minnesota Drive as Walter J. Hickle Parkway. We have Scott Thomas from DOT online if you have any questions for him. Again, thank you. I urge support of this bill.
Okay. Very good, Representative Lynn. Just question, why this section of the road versus...
We didn't go further, Mr. Chairman. We didn't go further north. We didn't want to get involved in changing address or anything like that. This bill would not change any addresses. It could be, mail could be addressed either to Minnesota Drive or to the Walter Hill. Either way, people would get their mail. And it actually, this goes nearby where Wally Hickle used to drive to work.
Okay. Questions, committee members? Senator Faircloth? No? Looked like you had one. Okay.
The mail.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, the sponsor answered it. I wanted to know if any... mailing addresses were going to be affected for businesses or residential along the way.
Okay. And let me just see. What? How big a sign is this?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it'd be two signs, okay. One at each end. It'd be similar to the Eisenhower corridor up there.
Okay. Okay. I was just looking at the dimensions. It looks kind of large, but if it's similar to the other signs, then that's fine. Okay. Well, thank you for the testimony.
Thank you.
And I don't have anybody online to testify. We do have, again, Scott Thomas with DOT. Online to answer any questions. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. Was there a planned dedication for the naming of this highway?
Dedication ceremony?
Was there dedication
ceremony? Was there plans for dedication?
None at this moment. I'm sure there will be something we get the bill passed. I don't know where the signing will be. That's one problem at a time.
Senator Bishop?
I'd just like to thank Representative Lynn for bringing this forward. And Senator Kelly and myself, we used to drive by the Hickle Highway quite a bit going north during the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, unofficially named, of course, but it's still there.
Okay, very good. We'll officially close public testimony then, unless there's somebody here. I don't see anybody. And we do have the fiscal note. Do you have a question on that, Senator Fairclough? Looks like it's $15,000 for these signs. It's a little bit little bit more than the previous sign, but there's two of them here. Okay. All right. There's no other questions about the fiscal note, about the bill. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question of DOT?
Yes. Scott Thomas, are you still online, sir?
I'm sorry, yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Senator Faircloth has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, I see that on the fiscal note that we're using the 2009 manual of uniform traffic control devices for looking at where we set signs and how we allocate signs along roadways. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
So my physical address is in Eagle River, and I see more and more signs being erected on single posts. And it says the memorial or dedication signing shall be limited to one side at an appropriate location in each route direction, each as an independent sign installation. And I'm wondering if we should modify that code, because I see independent single standing signs everywhere. And while this one may need to be independent, there is some benefit to co-locating some of those informational signs. Is this what's causing single spiked signs all over?
I would say this is not causing a great increase in signs. In the historical past, we have co-located bridge memorial signs with the name of the river and used the same post. In the case of some of these major highways, these signs are pretty large on an expressway or on an arterial. They usually take two posts, and if we add them to other signs, it gets to be a lot of lines of text to read. So we generally do try to locate these separately.
But you are trying to co-locate other smaller ones?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, additional questions? Seeing none, we discussed the fiscal note. There's one for $15,000. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I would move CS for House Bill 153, Transportation, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing, hearing none, bill moves out of committee. Thank you, Representative Lynn.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Welcome. Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Okay, we're going to bring Senate Finance back to order. Last bill we're going to consider today is House Bill 56, Passenger Vehicle Rental Tax. This is Representative Holmes's bill, and her trustee staff, chief of staff for 6 years, James Waldle, is going to present the bill on her behalf. And I know this is a bill she's been trying to get passed for several years. And so, if Mr. Waldle, if you could tell us all about the bill, introduce it, and be available for questions. The floor is yours.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Meyer. My name is James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. To begin with, I'd like to apologize that Representative Holmes is unable to be here this morning. She is over in the Finance Committee of the other body discussing oil taxes, but she very much appreciates the opportunity for us to discuss HB 56 with you. As you mentioned, this is a bill that in one form or another has been around the legislature for a while. In fact, last session passed through the Senate and was seen by a number of the members who were there in the last organization. Quite simply, it eliminates the passenger vehicle rental tax for the purposes of motorcycle rentals, which is a very small portion of the passenger vehicle rental tax. When that was originally envisioned and passed by the legislature, motorcycles were not considered. In fact, the legislature exempted recreational vehicles or RV rentals from the 10% vehicle rental tax, but never discussed motorcycles because nobody realized they were being rented. And it wasn't until much later that a Department of Revenue employee was driving along in Anchorage and noticed that a business was renting them, then conferred with the Department of Law and realized that they should be levying the tax on motorcycles as well. Motorcycles are an inherently sort of different type of rental than regular passenger vehicles, which are rented year-round, often to businesses and many folks who travel for many different reasons, whereas motorcycles are rented only for recreational tourism and only in certain times of the year. Nope, there's not much interest in renting a motorcycle in Alaska during the wintertime, obviously, and that increases the cost of the overhead of the business, in addition to the cost of a motorcycle rental already being much, much higher than that of a regular rental car. The 10% rental tax is very difficult to deal with when you're looking at maybe a 10-day trip on a motorcycle with a cost of about $200 a day. That 10% tax ends up being, you know, an extra day on the trip or $200 overall and becomes burdensome on travelers. Travelers who rent motorcycles stay in hotels. They're obviously not going to be staying in their RV like folks who rent RVs. They're obviously going to be eating in restaurants in Alaska and contributing through local sales tax and bed taxes. Elimination of this tax will help folks grow their motorcycle rental businesses here in Alaska and bring more travelers, independent travelers, into the state and make it easier to keep them here for longer. And with that, if the committee has any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Okay, very good. I did speak to the sponsor about this bill, and she was open to maybe having them pay a small percent tax. But then when we looked at the total amount that we get, which is $12,000, that even if we reduce that half, then you're only talking $6,000. It's going to cost more to collect it than what you're going to get. So she kind of pretty much talked me into just zero tax. And henceforth, that's why we've got the bill before us. But I would like to hear from other members. It is a relatively small amount. Do you have a Harley yourself?
No, sir. My wife, since we have our first child on the way, has told me I'm not allowed to ride motorcycles.
Okay, very good. Is this where did this idea come from?
This idea was actually Senator Meyer, Mr. Chair, James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. It was brought to us by the motorcycle rental businesses themselves. As I said, several years ago, the Department of Revenue realized that these businesses were in existence and that this tax applied to them and began taxing them. It was surprising to everyone involved. Actually, the Department of Revenue originally asked for back taxes for the previous 19 years that they had been doing it, and eventually decided that that was sort of a punitive measure and looked at it just prospectively going forward. Since then, we've been working to sort of close this unintended consequence that resulted from the passenger vehicle rental tax never discussing motorcycle rentals.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Senator Faircloth, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, my son has a Harley, but he doesn't rent it.
Okay. Is there any public testimony? Senator Bishop.
Is revenue on the line?
Do we have I don't have any sheets. Is anybody here? Okay. Can I have that, please? Oh, I had it, huh? Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. We do have a couple people here. It looks like, yes, we have Brandon Spanos with the Department of Revenue, and also Nancy Hall with the Mansu Valley Alaska Motorcycle Ventures. So are you sure your question then for
yep.
revenue, Senator Bishop? Okay, go ahead.
My question is, do we tax snow machine rentals?
Sorry, it was just unmuting as you asked your question. Was the question, do we tax snow machines?
Do we tax snow machine rentals?
For the record, this is Brandon Spanos with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. I'm the excise supervisor. And we tax recreational vehicles. I'm not actually 100% of snow machine vehicles fall within that.
Thank you.
I don't believe we do, but I might have to double check, honestly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. That's a good question. It seems to me that I think probably all motorized vehicles is how we picked up the motorcycles, so that would also pertain to the snow machines.
I believe actually it's for highway use, so I think that it's that does not they are not taxed because they're not highway use.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor or for the revenue? We do have, looks like, at least one person here to testify. So let's go into public testimony. Nancy Hall, are you online?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Nancy, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. If you could, just put your name on the record and proceed with
your okay. For the record, my name is Nancy Hall. That's H-U-L-L, and I represent Alaska Motorcycle Adventures. We live in Palmer, and we rent the motorcycles about 10 minutes from the Anchorage Airport. Good morning, Honorable Chairman Kelly, Honorable Chairman Meyer, and members of the Finance Committee. I just want to say thank you so much and let you know how much I truly appreciate your scheduling of House Bill 56 in this last busy week of your session. Considering all the information that you have received and previously heard regarding this bill, there's only one point that I'd like to share with you today. Most likely, there will be a motorcycle rental company starting in Whitehorse, Yukon, Canada, in the next year or so. As you know, the Condor coming from Frankfurt, Germany, stops in Whitehorse first. The numerous clients we have coming from Europe, the Mediterranean, and Scandinavia travel up Condor. These folks spend 2 to 3 weeks traveling in Alaska and the Yukon. Considering their vehicle rental tax for that 2 to 3 week rental will be $400 to $600 per motorcycle, the exclusion of motorcycles from the vehicle rental tax will provide a significant incentive for these clients to continue to begin their travel in Anchorage rather than these clients beginning their travel in the Yukon and only spending a few days in Alaska. We want them to start in Alaska and only spend a few days in the Yukon. The latter puts many, many more tourist dollars into Alaska businesses, not just mine. So please help me to continue to grow my business and to grow Alaska tourism. Thank you very much for your support.
Okay, Nancy, thank you very much for your testimony. We do have a letter from you as well, so I appreciate you keeping us informed. Senator Dunlap, any question? Okay. All right, I think we're good. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Okay, if there's no one else to testify, we'll close public testimony. And additional discussion? Senator Faircloth?
Mr. Chairman, If I could point the committee's attention to fiscal note number one. It's from the Department of Revenue. It's to allocate it to the Taxation Division, OMB component number 2476. In FY15 through FY19, and I believe in future years, it shows a loss of revenue of $12,000, as you earlier stated. Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion?
Committee, ready for a motion? Okay. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 56 from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing here none, the bill moves out of committee. Okay, that concludes our meeting for today. We will be back this afternoon at 1:30 to take up House Bill 4, and then we'll have several small bills like this again tomorrow morning. Yes, Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, the reason that there was a delay on HB 30 was because I was considering an amendment. I'm wondering if that could be considered for the 1:30 meeting, if we have everything taken care of.
Definitely. I think House Bill 30 is the audit bill. We heard it's a Speaker Chenault's bill. There didn't seem to be any objections to it. I know you wanted to make an amendment, which may or may not fit on his bill. And if you are ready by 1:30, then I would think that we could take that up and move it out fairly quickly.
Thank you.
I'm not sure, actually, though. Hopefully we'll start on time this afternoon, but I think we have a busy floor session as well. So we'll just see how this afternoon goes. But, yeah, I think that'd be great if we could bring that up this afternoon, House Bill 30. Okay, anything else come before the committee? If not, we stand adjourned until 1:30 this afternoon. All right, we're going to bring Senate Finance to order. Currently, we have Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, Senator Faircloth, and myself, Senator Meyer. Others will be coming as we proceed here. Apologize for the delay. Floor session went much longer than we anticipated, but it's that time of year, so I guess we shouldn't be too surprised. First thing I'd like to do, though, is we were holding up a bill, waiting for an amendment. We're not going to do the amendment, so I'd like to just go ahead and kick the bill out so that the speaker at least gets one bill passed maybe this year. We heard a presentation by Sharon Kelly. We had the public testimony. We talked about House Bill 30, State Agency Performance Audits. It's a good bill. And we heard from Chris Curtis, our LBNA chair. We went over the fiscal notes. I don't see anything else we need to do to this bill. And I know my co-chair is doing press availability. He does my motions. Are you able, my vice chair able to do that?
Mr. Chairman, have we reviewed the fiscal notes already?
I think we did already, yes.
Okay.
If there's any questions, though, let's certainly, I want to have members have an opportunity to ask. But
Mr. Chairman, I just highlight fiscal note number 3.
Okay.
In 2014, there's a proposal to expend $642,300 in FY15, $1,351,900 in FY16, $1,198,900 in FY17, $1,324,900 in FY2008, $1,177,900, and the same amount in FY2019. For those that just may be joining us, the CS for House Bill number 30, Finance, initiates annual performance audits and reviews of the executive branch agencies beginning with calendar year 2014 and continually.
annually on a 10-year cycle that's proposed inside the bill.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Yeah, these are basic costs, costs and expenses associated with doing the numerous audits of our state agencies. Seems reasonable.
Yep.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 30, Finance 28-LS0180/Y from committee with individual fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Okay, and before we proceed, Senator Kelly has joined us as well. Is there any objections to the bill moving out of committee? Seeing none, bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're going to bring Senate Finance back to order the rest of the afternoon. We want to take up House Bill 4. As mentioned yesterday, we do have some invited testimony. We have Mr. Walker, and are you Mr. Richards?
I am.
Okay, excellent. We're going to hear from them first, and then we'll give the sponsors of the bill an opportunity to speak after Mr. Walker and Mr. Richards. And then if members have questions concerning RCA, which we also mentioned that we would want to investigate a little bit more, I think we'll have somebody online for RCA as well, although I don't see him online yet. So.
In person, actually.
Oh, in person, that's even better. Okay, great. Okay, we may want to get your name. And okay. All right. So with that, is there anything come before the committee? I guess I should have asked that earlier. Seeing none, Mr. Walker, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
And members of the Juneau, by the way.
Thank you. For the record, Bill Walker, Walker Richards, and joining me.
I'm Craig Richards.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to present. I know it's a busy time for you. We will move through quickly. You know, one thing I would ask, Mr. Chairman, if it's at all possible, I've had the situation in the past and presented it to the committee, that after the presentation, when there's a response to what we've had to say, if we have sort of an opportunity to be part of, you know, either discussion of that or, you know, rebuttal or explain some of the, you know, we'll still be here during that process. So we would just ask an opportunity to just briefly a few minutes just to respond to any concern raised about anything testimony that we've made.
Okay, let me see if I understand. You want time for questions at the end of the presentation? Or
no, after the response to our presentation, I think will be followed by the bill sponsor. We just want to let you know we will be here.
Okay.
Remain here and be happy to respond to any questions that may come up as a result of that.
Okay, that'll be great. Yeah, if somebody has additional questions for you, we can have you come back. Okay, very good. Then, Mr. Walker.
All right, thank you very much. Let me just start off with by just an introductory comment that this is a significant issue for Alaska. It has been for decades. We've watched many iterations come and go. It doesn't come naturally for me to be opposed to anything that has the word pipeline in it. But I'm going to be presenting today an opposition of House Bill 4. The email from the staff saying we need to keep our comments contained to the bill before you, and we certainly intend to do that. Some questions have come up in this discussion at this committee that I think we can help answer. So I have a couple of slides I'd like to, you know, briefly answer that. And I think our mission is to answer questions that we've heard, and obviously we prefer to be interrupted and ask questions as we go through this presentation. I understand the time constraints, Mr. Chairman, and we will be sensitive to that.
Okay.
Just a very quick overview of sort of what we'll be going through. We'll be talking about some of the other alternatives of LNG imports. There's some issues about whether a GEA is in violation or HB4 is in violation of GEA. We'll talk a bit about the regulatory structure of House Bill 4, some concerns we have about that. Talk a bit about the project scope, and also what happens if HB4 structure is blended into a large pipe. Just for a little bit of background, we have Mr. Richards and I have a fair amount of background on TAPS matters and associated with that, so that we draw upon that knowledge and experience in this presentation today. Touching a bit on 369, sort of was the creator of some of this of House Bill 4, the predecessor, I should say. It set out the definition of what an in-state pipeline is. An in-state pipeline, by definition, 369 is a pipeline running from North Slope to Tidewater at some location. Project was amended to include the in-state line running from North Slope to Tidewater. It could be either in Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound, and there's no problem with that. But you know, looking at House Bill 369, you know, one of the directions of that was to participate in a export process. They're asked to encourage either apply for a license or encourage those that had a license get an extension. And so there was clearly an export piece of 369 language specifically about that. Also, there was a discussion about value added associated with 369. So in 369, you know, first came about, it looked like it was something that was going to advance a large volume line that would be good for all of Alaskans. And the other issue is that it also talked about adding the export piece to it if the increased volume would lower the cost of energy to Alaskan consumers. And so it has morphed significantly since then to what it is today under House Bill 4 versus what 369 was very clear in what those efforts were to be. And of course, the distances on the two, Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, are roughly the same, roughly 800 miles from Prudhoe Bay to Cook Inlet, and the same to Prince William Sound. The next slide I put in, just because there's been discussion about, you know, cost of energy to Alaskans outside of the rail belt, if you will. In 2011, we had a study done by a company called PDC Harris Group. The Alaska Gas Line Port Authority did a very thorough analysis of the cost of energy outside of the rail belt. Could only afford to do two communities. The obvious one was an easy one was Fairbanks because of their immediate need, and the other one was Bethel. This company did a a very thorough analysis. We have not included the entire report. We have it with us if you'd like a copy of it. But it it shows the city gate price of gas into Fairbanks at $5.29 and a significant savings in energy costs of Fairbanks over the life of the project. And we did the same for, we asked them to do one community outside of the rail belt, and then that was or outside of the pipeline corridor, and the community they selected was Bethel. And in the Bethel, this way here, in the Bethel analysis, it showed that up to a 65% reduction in cost, and what they said was the savings would be based upon, I was a little surprised they did it this way, it would be LNG out of an LNG terminal at some location on coastal Alaska, and taken in as LNG rather than as compressed natural gas. And again, they have tremendous amounts of spreadsheets associated with the work they did. It was very thorough, and I'm not going to go through that now, obviously, for time constraints, but I wanted you to be aware that the large volume and the liquefaction brought in the maximum reduction in cost in rural Alaska. There were some questions about, can Alaska compete? Wood McKenzie did this in 2011. This is one slide of about a 55-slide presentation they did, analysis they did on Alaska. What they did is they took the first three numbers you see on the buildup for the cost of gas delivered in Japan. The first three numbers are from the open season from TransCanada in 2010. In fact, I brought one of the seven binders from that open season, a very thorough open season. TransCanada is certainly a very well-known, reputable company, and working in conjunction with ExxonMobil in their open season. So they took the numbers from the question or the challenge to Wood Mackenzie was, can Alaska compete? In order to know if Alaska can compete, what's the cost of gas from Puto Bay to Tokyo? And we asked them to not use any of the numbers that we had working with Bechtel. We said, please use off-the-shelf numbers. If you see two numbers out there, pick the higher number. Don't do us any favors by picking lower numbers. And so that's what they did. They used the first three numbers are from, like I say, from the open season of TransCanada, and then the balance they used based upon their knowledge in the world. Wood Mackenzie has a world gas model, and I think I've never been to a presentation anywhere in the world that someone wasn't using a Wood Mackenzie slide or a presentation of some sort. Very, very, very well known. So the first question was, what does it cost according to your numbers? The surprising number, a very surprising number, is the first number, the 26 cents. That's the cost of putting it into the pipe. No place else in the world has gas, conventional gas, that they can put in the pipe at 26 cents. That's the number that caused them to invite me back to Houston for a meeting halfway through their work to discuss that. Again, we provided none of these numbers. They all came from third-party interests and from the open season.
We do have a question. Senator Bishop?
Yes, Mr. Walker, could you back up to that slide? The 26 cents for getting gas in the pipe?
Yes.
And that's what prompted their trip back to Houston when they saw that number. And is that because there's no required infield drilling for Prudhoe Bay? It's a greenfield project?
Senator Bishop, to the chair, that's correct. It's because it's associated gas that comes out and with the oil and is reinjected. So the cost is extremely low. As a comparison, in the British Columbia projects, that same number is in the $3 range, because you need to go out and find it, create the infrastructure, and bring it to the wellhead. So it's a huge advantage that Alaska has. Many times people will say, well, we have an 800-mile pipeline to Tidewater, either Cook Inlet or Prince William Sound. Isn't that a huge advantage? And I remind them that that's one piece of the equation. The pieces that we need to focus on also is shipping costs of 59 cents. We have a cost of 26 cents to put it into the pipe. I mean, it's a very different. We have a cold climate, and we're 40% more efficient in making LNG in Alaska than we are in Gorgon, Australia. And so those, you have to blend all those pieces together to see where we fit on the playing field.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next question we asked is, how do we compare? And I asked Wood Mackenzie, I said, rather than me give you the names of the companies or the projects around the world, you select. And I said, select a handful in Australia, British Columbia, and the U.S. Gulf Coast, and sort of see where we fit in the scheme of things with our number of 850 delivered into Japan versus other projects. So you see the first project at Gorgon. I'm not going to go through each of these. Some of the Gulf Coast, Sabine Pass at 1050, Kitimat at 1176. These projects are, some of them are at FID, final investment decision. Some are under construction. Gorgon is nearing completion in construction. That's a project of about a little over $55 billion at this point. And it's for a project about a third smaller than what we were anticipating with the Wood Mackenzie analysis.
Actually, we have a question from Senator Fairclough. Also, I want to welcome Senator Olson for
the committee. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. This makes Alaska look really competitive. Did you look and ask how many are less expensive? Do we know how many are out there? I mean, this looks like a pretty optimal case that's before us. So.
Senator Fairclough, to the chair, I actually thought we were going to be in the middle of a range, quite honestly, so we could see for that very reason. That's a good question. I think you would certainly find some that are what are called brownfield projects in maybe a third train or fourth train in Papua New Guinea, in Qatar, whether or not we already have it all in place. All they're doing is adding another train. So are there absolutely, there are others out there that, but those are mostly, if not all of them, are what they call a brownfield project. We're just adding another train. So on a greenfield project, I think these are fairly, I mean, region-wise, are fairly typical. Most of these, if not all of these, are on shale gas. Some are coalbed methane gas out of Australia. And that's what causes the price to go up, is really it's the exploration and gathering process that adds additional expense.
Mr. Walker, I haven't checked today, but what's the price on the market today for gas?
Well, and Senator Fairclough, through the chair, the Henry Hub price is in the $3 range, or just under $3, and the Asian market price doesn't quite have an index like Henry Hub, so you can't really go to the newspaper and take a look at it. But it's trading anywhere in the $12 to $14 range. I think you can find some lower and some higher, but I think that's the long term contracts.
Right. So I'll be looking to see how Alaska will compete at $8.50 with a market that has under $4 out there. I understand you're showing us places that are more expensive, but it's selling on an open market now for much less than we're looking at under these scenarios. Is that correct?
Yeah, Senator Farquhar, through the chair. Actually, one of those projects that set $3 is a Sabine Pass, a project at $10.50. And again, the difference there is you add another $3 or $3.50 to the shipping, the cost of shipping from the Gulf Coast. The distance is significantly greater. Now, there's an effort to widen the Panama Canal, but I sat in on a presentation on that, and they explained that the tariff for the Panama Canal is going to be very close to the cost of going around the greater distance. So they said as far as a cost savings, it probably won't be a huge savings. So, again, our distance is our real friend on that one.
Okay, very good. Before I go to Senator Dunleavy, I want to welcome Governor Sheffield to the audience. Welcome, Governor. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Chair. Just two questions. The 850 is our gas land in Japan. Correct?
Senator Dunleavy, the chair, that's correct.
The next question is, and I don't know if you know this, Mr. Walker, right now, but offhand, what is the distance between Alaska to Japan versus, let's say, Kitimat to Japan, distance-wise?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I don't actually have the exact number, but my recollection, it was about the same or very close, if not a bit shorter.
Thank you.
And then Senator Kelly.
Mr. Walker, does that $8.50 include the purchase price?
Senator Kelly, through the chair, it does not. This is the delivered price and at the wellhead. And the delivered price, typically, if someone is selling it at the wellhead price, is that this would be, you would add that to the price. In other words, if someone's paying, $3 or $4 at the wellhead or $2, you add that to that. And it was apples to apples with the other projects as well. So none of those others include the wellhead price either.
Yeah, and this is calculated on a netback basis, so the $850 includes taxes and royalty. So the purchase price would effectively be the difference between the $850 number and your $13 price in Japan.
This slide, I'm not going to go through it, but there's some questions about it. Is there, you know, for years I always heard that gas was sort of a step child to oil, and there really was no revenue in it, and I think this dispels that theory. You know, they had a range in estimates from, obviously a huge swing between $220 billion and $419 billion of revenue to Alaska. And they looked at it as a snapshot in time of what the oil and gas taxes were at that time, because they don't do projections based on what they think might change, and so that was the that was what it was in 2011. You know, a couple things that to keep in mind, and this range, the revenue range from the first year, potentially $2.4 billion in revenue to the state, and increased to a high of $24 billion in year 30. One thing to keep in mind on this analysis is that this was done on assuming that there was a volume of 2.7 in volume of export. And the reason for the 2.7 is a couple of reasons. One is that looked like that was what the market could take at the time, and also that was the maximum allowed under of offtake on the North Slope under the ALGC Rule 9 allocation that was established in 1977 and has been looked at several times since then, and as recently as 2007. And the ALGC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, has determined that while no one has applied for an offtake from Prudhoe Bay for a large gas sale, they found no reason to change that 2.7 limitation. So we have stayed with that 2.7 limitation for that reason. We attended and participated in the hearings with AOGCC, so we feel that's a pretty solid number. There has been speculation that if someone actually applied for an offtake, that number would be increased, but there's no guarantee of that. So that's the number that we have today. There was a initial open season in 2010 held by TransCanada, and we don't know. Well, we don't know the results of that. We know it was not successful because in May of this year, they sent a letter. TransCanada, ExxonMobil sent a letter to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and said that was not a successful open season. Since then, under the terms of AGEA, they needed to have additional expressions of interest every 2 years, which they did. In September of 14th of 2012 was the closing date for that expression of interest. It was non-binding. You know, whether it's an open season or was an open season or not, I guess that can be argued over in semantics, but it was a request to the world to say who's interested. And here's the response that we know of. We don't know of. We happen to know these two because one of them was done. A lot of the Korean work companies responded as a result of work done by the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority on the right side from the Resource Energy Inc. out of Japan, and the response was pretty strong. It was 200% of what was projected as far as the 2.7 BCF. 5.5 is. A strong response, and these are letters of written letters of intent, letters of interest, again non-binding, but every project in the world that I followed, when they receive letters of intent, it's a big announcement. It's a huge announcement, and you read about it in every oil and gas publication that there is. So it's all projects start off with initial letters of intent. You know, those move to development agreement, joint development agreement, you know, binding agreements. So it should be. We certainly felt it was great news that we had that kind of a response from the Asian market to on Alaska's gas. And you know, I just want to comment briefly on a couple of those companies, certainly on the Korean side of the slide. Having met with each of those companies multiple times in Korea, what they like about Alaska's gas is the BTU content, the high the wet gas. They don't have to buy. In lots of locations around the world, they buy dry gas and bring it to their country, and they buy propane and bring it to their country. They blend the two, and that's what they use. From Alaska, our BTU content is very, very high, among the highest in the world, and they're very, very interested and excited about that. So That's a tremendous plus, and and has been received extremely well in every meeting that I participated in the Asian market. You know, one of the concerns that I have. Let me back up just a little bit on that slide. One of the concerns I have about HB4 is that, having had this kind of an open season that we paid for, we paid about $300 million to get to this point to have this open season, and we have rooms of books of exactly what the open season consisted of, the price for the tariff to Tidewater, etc. To have this expression of interest and this kind of response, and then we sort of step away and nothing happened on that, and we focus on a line that doesn't have an export piece to it. It's just very concerned about what message that sends to the world market about Alaska's gas. I have received emails from Asian companies that have been here and have presented here that have said, when Alaska is serious about their gas, let us know. We'd be interested, but we're a little bit confused. A week after the Fukushima earthquake, we brought representatives from Tokyo Gas, from Mitsubishi to Juneau. It was scheduled before the earthquake. When the earthquake came, we said, by all means, we will reschedule. And they said, by all means, we want to be there now more than ever. And they came here and were very anxious to discuss, and did discuss, with the Commissioner of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner as well, 2 days about their interest in Alaska. I met with some of the legislature. Went from here to British Columbia and engaged there and put in over $1 billion for a project there, and continued on south to the Gulf Coast and did the same, another $1 billion in an LNG project there. They are serious. They were serious, and I worried about the message that we're sending to the market at this point. I think there's little question there's market interest in Alaska.
Senator Faircliffe, question?
Certainly. Mr. Walker, you indicated that this was a good showing for this diameter of a pipe. So I'm wondering what would we have to have flow through the pipe on a large diameter pipe to make it cost effective? How much gas would have to come through?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, the analysis that, I mean, the most beneficial to the state would be 2.7. We've seen analysis at a break even at 2 BCF in the way of volume, but really 2.7 is what the analysis that we've done. So if you can return on 2.7, you can return 200 to 400 billion to the state. Obviously, it's a smaller number to do the break even, if that's your question. And I apologize if I misunderstood your question.
Is that at an $8.50 price? That you only need 2.7 to pay for the cost to make it economical?
That was, Senator Faircloth, through the chair, that was assuming that you were using the Asian market prices. That's correct.
So at 2.7 BCF, $8.50 would be the break-even point. An $8.50 price would be the break-even point for a 2.7 BCF project. But, of course, the market price in Asia right now is substantially higher than $8.50.
But that's without the product, right? You have to add $3 to that?
So it's generally assumed that the producer is going to be the shipper under the WoodMac analysis, so it's netback pricing. So it's not assumed that it's being purchased at the wellhead. It's being assumed that the producer's price is just the difference between the cost and what they get at the point of delivery. So the price is the netback. So how about what oil works?
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, go ahead.
What size of pipe is that with 2.7 BCF pushing through it?
through the chair, Senator Faircloth, you could... lots of discussion with Bechtel Corporation about the size of the pipe. You can put 2.7 through a 48-inch pipe, X80 heavy steel pipe with very, very little compression. But what they kept saying is you're going to put your money in your pipe or your compression. So you can take it. You can take that 48-inch pipe at 2.7 billion cubic feet of gas and increase that to 5.9 billion cubic feet with compression. So they said put your pipe in one time and then add your compression. So I believe it could be done in a smaller pipe than as long as it was X80 and heavy wall pipe. We have priced everything in the past at 48 because of the analysis done by Bechtel Corporation that that's the most ideal size pipe. Could it be done on a smaller pipe? Absolutely it could. What their advice to us many times was, when you're opening up the largest untapped basin in the world, don't start off with the smallest pipe you can. Don't try to save your money on pipe. Get the biggest pipe you can justify, and then grow from there.
Mr. Chairman, last question. So we're pushing 2.75 billion BCF through a 48-inch pipe. Can you tell me the depreciation or what life cycle you're using for that pipe to create it as economically viable?
Senator Faircloth,
that returns the money that you've said to the state.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, as far as the life cycle of the pipe, I mean, I think the pipe will be there for a long, long time. I think that's not a concern as far as the pipe wearing out. What their concern is that when you can move 2.7 without any exploration for gas, and you're in a basin that is one of the largest untapped gas fields in the world, go with a larger pipe.
Mr. Chairman, I may not have been clear. We were talking depreciation cycles, and to look at your tariff rate, it's important to know the life cycle that you have on the pipe. So did you use 25 years, 30 years, 40 years? That's where I was trying to get to, not that the pipe would be worn out.
Sorry. Senator Faircloth, through the chair, I apologize. It was assuming it would be a 30-year project, the finance on a 30-year project. And yeah.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
And if I could just add to that, what you saw on the open season slide with the breakdown of the cost, that was for a 48-inch pipe, X80 48-inch pipe, and the tariff was like $1.74, I believe, to Tidewater on that 2.7 volume. And of course, if you were able to double that volume, all those numbers would go in half. As far as the cost, the tariff would go from 170 down to probably 89, 90 cents kind of range, and those kinds of things would cut in. Liquefaction would go down somewhat. So, but again, that was assuming a 2.7. And a couple more slides, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Richards. You know, the real challenge I see with House Bill 4 is Alaska has two significant problems. One is the immediate energy crisis in Alaska, and it's not in any particular region. It's widespread. Certainly well known in Fairbanks, no question, and certainly an issue in Cook Inlet as gas continues to decline. But there's an immediate problem. There's no question about that. That needs to be resolved with an immediate solution. And the second issue is that, so the long-term fiscal needs of the state. You know, we've all seen analysis of what's going to happen when the infrastructure is in place in the lower 48 to get gas to the West Coast. How much is that going to drop the price of our oil? Some have seen it in the $90 range, $90 to $100 range, $95. That's going to be very, very significant. So that's the long-term problem. And my concern with House Bill 4 is it really addresses neither one of those problems. It doesn't solve either one of those problems. It doesn't solve the immediate problem. And we're talking in 2014, 2015 range to solve the immediate problem. And then the long-term problem, the concern is that the market will continue to be confused by Alaska's lack of activity on the large line and continue to sign up long-term contracts elsewhere. And that's the way it works on LNG projects. You sign into long-term contracts on a take-or-pay, and once you have enough, you have enough. I mean, it's not like a liquid trading hub in the AECO hub in Alberta or someplace else. So you want to be in that market to those long-term contracts. There's been as far as the immediate side on Cook Inlet. I found of interest the ANGDA analysis study done by a company now owned by Chicago Bridge and Iron of the cost of bringing in LNG, and that was anticipated then at about a $60 million cost to convert the existing LNG facility. Unfortunately, since the time of that study, that facility has now ceased exporting because the license expired as of March 31st of this year, and it is available. I've heard numbers in the range of $80 million as far as what it would be to turn that plant around to import LNG. It certainly sounds counterproductive, counterintuitive to have that discussion, but the utilities are in the process of doing that now. They formed a consortium. They're looking at it very aggressively. One thing to keep in mind, is the cost of import is not necessarily the cost of the burner tip for that gas. You have to look at what is the volume, how much shortfall would there be. If there's a 10% shortfall or a 20% shortfall or 30, that's the amount that will be brought in. So you take that price, say it's $9 to $12, you blend it with the current price. The blended price is much closer to the current price now rather than the import price. You can't just look at the import price. And the location the import would come from certainly would be on the West Coast. It would be the U.S. West Coast or out of British Columbia. It clearly would not necessarily need to be indexed to a Japanese crude cocktail, which is the price of gas in the Asian market. So we think that's something that's going to happen. That's just going to happen because it has to, because we're in that situation of in 2014, 2015, if there's some months in the winter that there's be a shortfall, they'll do that. And that's also in that's cited as in our book as tab
exhibit two
of the handout. And one of the things that has been discussed a lot about House Bill 4 is that it creates a lot of pressure on the producers to do something with the North Slope gas by having a small volume line. I've never subscribed to that theory. I think the most pressure would be put on the producers if Alaska is importing LNG, and the rest of the world will really be scratching their heads about us importing LNG when we re-inject 8.4 billion cubic feet of gas every day on the North Slope. So if the goal is pressure on the producers, import LNG, and you'll see a lot of Alaskans wondering what in the heck is going on that we're importing LNG and yet we have so much available on the North Slope. The next slide comes from the legal opinion issued by Mr. Bullock of Legislative Council February 15th, where he raises some fairly significant questions about is there a violation of, and I know Ben, that there have been some discussion previously, not so much at this committee perhaps, but others earlier when the bill progresses through the legislature, is there a violation of AGIA under House Bill 4? And I guess an interesting analysis, he's not convinced that AGIA is even valid today. His opinion is talks about, the AGIA process license was for line to Alberta, and now that they've issued a letter to FERC saying, we're not doing that open season anymore, that's done. Are they in compliance of AGIA? Good question. That's certainly something that we should know a clear answer to. Secondly, he says that when there was an amendment made in May under the AGIA process, an amendment by the dual commissioners under AGIA to talk about LNG under AGIA, he's not convinced that that is a valid amendment, because if AGIA was truly a project into Alberta, then how can they amend a project that is actually no longer in existence? That would be a different project. He also talked about the sheer volume. I mean, the sheer volume, and it's been clear that the AGIA line has a potential of 1.6 billion cubic feet on a 36-inch line. The question is whether or not do you measure that based upon the initial throughput or the maximum throughput. He doesn't know. I don't think anybody here knows. And that's a question, because if AGIA is in place today and still valid today, then it certainly appears that it is, because there's communications from the governor talking about that and various announcements, etc. Then there's reason to be concerned about whether or not this would violate AGIA. That those are answers that I think would want to be very clear. Because that would have a very significant impact on the fiscal note associated with House Bill 4. So I'm going to, at this point, turn this over to Mr. Richards, and he'll begin on some of the regulatory issues.
Very good. Mr. Richards? Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Unlike Mr. Walker, a lot of you don't know me. My name is Craig Richards. I grew up in Fairbanks. I went to West Valley High School, attended school on the East Coast, where I received not only an undergraduate degree in finance and a law degree, but an MBA as well. I've practiced law since about 2000. That includes clerking for Ralph Beislein. It also includes having done a substantial amount of public finance work as a young attorney, and then ultimately coming into Bill's practice about 10 years ago, where I focused my practice exclusively on oil and gas issues and public finance issues. And that includes a lot of tax litigation related to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, as well as a lot of work on an LNG project, sort of in a support role, particularly on the technical side for the Alaska Gas and Port Authority, the City of Valdez, Mitsubishi, Sempra. So I think, like Bill, I have a pretty deep background in a lot of the issues that are before you today, including having testified a number of times over the years on gas pipeline issues.
Okay. Thank Mr. If you could, I just want to acknowledge Senator Hoffman's here. Thank you, Mr. Richards. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. So I just thought I'd follow up a little bit on Mr. Walker's last slide and sort of try to drive this home a little bit. Legislative counsel, your own attorneys, have told you that HB4 runs the risk of violating AGIA. If that is true, it's going to cost a whole lot of money under the exclusivity provision. However, if it's not true, and AGIA, as he suspects in the legal opinion, is in fact no longer, TransCanada is no longer in compliance, then the question that we all have to ask ourselves is, if he's right, and that's the current state of affairs, or that potential is where we are, why are we talking about a small volume line? I think we all recognize that a large volume line is in the state's interests. The justification for HB4 in pursuing a small volume line is that AGIA prevents the state from doing an alternative large volume project. So to me, it doesn't fit. If AGIA is not in effect, as your attorneys think it might not be, then this project should instantly be morphed the largest project it can become, because that's in all of our best interests. All right. Go ahead.
I am. Let me just say one thing before we move on. I missed one spot, and I want to. I there's a slide I handed out that's it was presented in Rome at the World LNG Summit, and it's called the spaghetti slide, and it's one of the few slides I've seen that had Alaska on there, so I was very pleased about that. But that's the one, and what that emphasizes is how close we are to the market. You know, and when I was in Norway on the trip in Norway a couple of years ago, we went to the Hammerfest LNG facility, Snøhvit facility, and that's about as far away from the market as you can get, and yet they are shipping from there. And so you look at where we are in comparison, it's pretty difficult to not recognize that significant advantage of our close proximity. So thank you.
So the majority of my presentation, except for a couple of slides at the end, is going to be first explaining the current regulatory structure that's in place for an Alaska natural gas pipeline under the federal system and the state system. And this is the regulatory framework in terms of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC's jurisdiction, and also the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the RCA's jurisdiction, and the protections that are currently in place under both FERC and RCA to protect the interests of the state of Alaska and to protect the interests of independent shippers. And the reason I thought it was important to explain what's in place is because HB4 is a fundamental rewrite of the regulatory structure of how gas pipelines are regulated in the state of Alaska. It is inconsistent with federal jurisdiction treatment, and it is inconsistent with existing state jurisdictional treatment. So the question I want to leave everyone with, I hope, is a simple question of why. Because it doesn't make sense to me why we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater and why we are wholesale changing the way we regulate an off-slope gas pipeline. Now, in 2004, Congress passed a law, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act, and it required the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to adopt open season regulations for the treatment of, to basically establish regulatory jurisdiction and treatment for an open season for an Alaska gas pipeline off the slope. And Congress specifically mandated that FERC ensure that an off-slope gas pipeline, that gas out of fields other than Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson be able to enter it. That was a concern of Congress, is that we would build a capacity-constrained line that would not allow further development or basin. Essentially, Prudhoe and Point Thompson would fill it up, and you wouldn't have continued exploration of the basin. And that was Congress's concern, and that was FERC's concern. And so in 2004 and 2005, FERC undertook an open season regulatory rulemaking process where they essentially designed regulations to ensure that Alaska's North Slope Basin was opened up in the most efficient way possible through an Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline transportation project. And it led to a lot of soul searching in the state among independents, among the state of Alaska, among the legislatures, we'll discuss itself, among the public. And what came out was a set of rules that FERC adopted for the best way to ensure competition and access if you're going to build an Alaska natural gas pipeline. And of course, that in turn led to a bunch of a litigation where the North Slope producers challenged FERC's attempt and regulations they put in place to ensure open and competitive access. So I try not to read a bunch of quotes because you lose people, but I've got three or four in here that I think are worth reading. And the first one is an LB&A briefing paper that was written by Senator Terrio and Representative Samuels. So these are guys that you would call not enemies of the producers by any means. But it was a position paper that they drafted, and I've attached as Exhibit 6 to your binder, that discusses the competitive issues associated with an open season from the North Slope. And I'm going to read this one quote. Rational economic behavior suggests if the big three or similarly situated companies own the Alaska gas pipeline, they will use their vertically integrated market dominance to limit competitor access to the pipeline, as well as extract a high tariff from those who do gain access. More income for them, higher costs for the competitors, and lower wellhead values on which royalties and taxes are payable to the state of Alaska. In fact, this is the story of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Except that with TAPS, its status as a common carrier has thwarted any effort to use market dominance to limit access. TAPS tariffs, however, have proven to be an obstacle to competition and have been cited by more than one company as a reason for withdrawing from efforts to commercialize Alaska's resources. What this is saying is that Alaska, because it's dominated by three producers that have demonstrated a history of high tariffs and anti-competitive behavior, that you need to have open season regulations in place that ensure as open a process as possible for independence if we expect further development of our gas basin beyond Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. Or rather, as the LB&A briefing paper puts it, the challenge for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission then is to create rules that give birth to competition, even in the face of an Alaska pipeline that will be a natural monopoly and may be owned by those with production interests better served by suppressing competition. During the FERC open season process, the Alaska legislature, through the LB&A, actually weighed in. And this is how FERC summarized their testimony. The Alaska legislators conclude that, unlike the situation in the lower 48, there is no existing or foreseeable competitive environment in Alaska where the North Slope producers not only control the known gas reserves, but also may become the sponsors of the Alaska pipeline. Therefore, the Commission was right to not rely on market forces in Alaska to ensure the development, routing, sizing, and timing of an Alaska gas pipeline. So what LB&A is saying is that we don't have a competitive basin. So when FERC develops open season rules for an Alaska natural gas line, it needs not to apply some of the open market principles that it does for its regulatory treatment for lower 48 pipelines because of the lack of competition. And FERC heard it loud and clear, and I'll save you from reading this last quote on the next page because it's a long one, so you can read it yourself. But what FERC said is after looking at it and listening to Congress's mandate to ensure an open pipeline that will open the basin beyond Prudhoe and Point Thompson, is we said, yeah, there's competitive issues in Alaska. We recognize them and it's a problem. And thus we are imposing strict requirements on all proposals, and particularly on affiliate-owned projects, with respect to public disclosure of information to ensure that there is a level playing field. So what they're saying, FERC is saying here, is that there's only going to be one natural gas pipeline. Those are FERC's words. And because of that, it is imperative that several protections be made. For instance, FERC said it is imperative that the pipeline not be limited capacity. Because they didn't want a limited capacity pipeline coming out of Alaska, they did something that was pretty unique. FERC said that what we're going to do is we are going to maintain jurisdiction over the design basis of the pipeline. So FERC reserved to itself the power to order the project sponsor to build a larger project if it appeared there was interest from shippers to build on it. They didn't want a small project because they knew it would result in their basin not being developed. FERC was also concerned about access from future shippers. So FERC again did two things that were really quite extraordinary when they established open season rules for Alaska. The first one is they said if you have pre-subscription agreements, if people bid capacity coming in on the front end of the pipeline before the open season is held, if the open season is held and is successful, we're going to squeeze out the pre-subscription capacity on a pro rata basis. What that means is the open season responders get priority access to the pre-subscription guys. And the reason for that is simple. They didn't want Conoco, BP, and Exxon to design a small pipeline, come in, bid up all the capacity, and not allow independents through the open season to have access to that gas. And in fact, it's a pretty extraordinary provision under FERC. I'm not aware that they've ever done it before. But they went farther. They even put in a late bid provision. And what the late bid provision did, it said, for an Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline, even if you miss the open season, before construction and before you go to financing, if you come in late and you still want access as if you'd been to the open season, we're still going to let you and treat you as if you had made the open season. So it's a late bid provision that basically extends the open season if the shipper had a good reason. And the specific reason they did it is after you had a successful open season and it looked like the pipeline was going, they wanted to give explorers a couple of years to go up and prove up gas. So you get a couple of years, you get to prove up gas, and then you come in as the late bidder after the open season is closed, and you have the opportunity to actually access the pipeline and get your product to market. And the final area I wanted to discuss about FERC is they were extremely concerned about tariff rates being on parity between all shippers. And so they did a couple of things that were remarkable. The first one is they said if you have a pre-subscription agreement, that is if you're Conoco or BP or Exxon and you negotiate with an independent pipeline company or yourself an agreement for the terms of shipment, we're not only going to make that public, but we're going to mandate that any other shipper gets to choose among the pre-subscription agreements and accept those terms. So BP, Exxon, and Conoco, you don't get to go in on the front end and pre-negotiate favorable terms that other shippers don't have the same access to. They did that, and they specifically held, as we'll discuss in a later slide, that they are going to forego FERC policy in the lower 48 to allow incremental rates. They said, in Alaska, we are non-competitive. We have a non-competitive basin. So unlike in the lower 48s, where we have incremental shipping, we are going to create a presumption for rolled-in tariffs in Alaska. And it is on the pipeline owner to justify why you wouldn't have rolled-in rates. So that is a fundamentally different treatment for rates in Alaska. So why is this important? Why am I up here haranguing you about FERC jurisdiction and how the FERC doesn't open season? Well, the answer is it's always been assumed that on a highway project, certainly under the GA application, that FERC was going to have, it was going to be a jurisdictional FERC pipeline. It was going to ship interstate gas across the Canadian border and ultimately enter interstate commerce through the lower 48. So FERC would have jurisdiction. An in-state pipeline or an LNG export project is non-jurisdictional for FERC. So I need to say this again because it matters so much. FERC will not have jurisdiction over an export project, and it will not have jurisdiction over an in-state project. At least if FERC treats an export project consistent with how it was in the past. In 1987, the Yukon Pacific Corporation fully permitted a pipeline to Valdez, including receiving the export license from the Department of Energy. They also received an opinion from FERC that said, if you ship gas in-state through the state of Alaska to Valdez, you put it on tankers and you ship it to Asia, FERC doesn't have jurisdiction, non-jurisdictional. Additionally, there is sort of a loophole under the Natural Gas Act. The seven-section jurisdiction, which is jurisdiction over interstate pipelines and sale of natural gas in interstate pipelines, FERC doesn't have jurisdiction over pipelines that are owned by a political subdivision of a state if it doesn't cross state lines. So if the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation owns this pipeline, not only will it be FERC jurisdiction exempt because it doesn't go to the lower 48, it will be FERC jurisdiction exempt even if some of the gas does go to the lower 48, probably, because AGDC is a municipal corporation under the Natural Gas Act. So this is just a long way of saying that it is likely that FERC will not have jurisdiction over this project, which is not the end of the world, because we have the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has demonstrated itself to be fully competent to handle rate matters and access matters in a manner similar to how FERC has done so. But what is critical is that recognizing that FERC will not have power, will not have jurisdiction over this pipeline, that we empower the Regulatory Commission of Alaska with the jurisdictional tools to properly regulate access, rates, and expansion. And my concern with HB4 is it appears to do the opposite. It appears to disembowel the RCA's current existing regulatory authority. It has a bunch of embedded provisions in it that, rather than strengthening RCA jurisdiction in the absence of FERC jurisdiction, weakens it. And I don't get it. I don't understand why you do it. So I'm going to talk about some of those provisions and ultimately leave it up to you guys to decide whether or not you want strong jurisdiction over the pipeline for RCA. And I'm happy to take questions, by the way. So the first issue, the first change in the law that HB 4 enacts is a change in treatment of common carriage versus contract carriage for in-state pipelines. Now, this is not FERC's rules. This is current RCA law. And, well, the RCA and Title 38, the Alaska Lands Act. Currently under Alaska, the rule is this. If you're going to build an LNG project, you have to be a common carrier for in-state volumes. For export volumes, you can be a contract carrier. The reasons for that are pretty obvious. We want common carriage status for in-state volumes. Doing that ensures that new production on the North Slope can get into the pipeline. It ensures that utilities that didn't have gas purchase contracts in place, either in the inlet or the outlet of the pipe, at the time of the open season, can get gas into the pipeline. So common carriage in state is a good thing. That's what we have on all the oil pipelines in the state. It used to be the way most gas pipelines were treated, although the lower 48 is largely going to contract carriage. But there's trade-offs, as with like a lot of things. So when I look at HB 4, and I see that it removes the Senator Bishop, the chair.
Okay, Senator Bishop, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Craig, you had mentioned that the lower 48 gas pipelines are starting to go to the contract carriage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct, Senator.
And why is that?
Well, so FERC allowed, I want to say FERC. I think it was FERC and not Congress. I don't think it was by congressional act. I think it was by FERC policy. They just decided to deregulate. They thought that in the lower 48, you had competitive markets, you had competition between pipelines, and that light-handed regulation in this sense made sense, that barring a good reason, they were going to allow the competition between the pipelines to work, and contract carriage was part of that competition. But as I said, one of the things that FERC found was that Alaska lacks that competition. So FERC was certainly going to allow contract carriage, but the state didn't want to for in-state volumes. The state wanted common carriage because it had regulatory concerns about access on top of those of FERC. So that's why state law was amended about 10 years ago, I think, to require an in-state pipeline to have common carriage. Senator.
Okay, thank you. Senator FERC.
Thank you. HB 4 is suggesting contract carriage, is that correct?
That's correct.
And I'm looking at your 10% number, and HB 4 says that it's only pushing 0.5, trying to comply with AGEA, is that correct?
That's correct, Senator. So when I got to that point, I was certainly going to make the point that the state demand is about 250 MCF per day.
Which is 50%.
Which is 50% of a volume-restricted pipeline. It's about 10% of a three-train project.
I thought you were telling us what the problem with HB4 was, but the 10% isn't actually getting to the speaking to that portion, right?
Well, I am, because HB4 is designed to handle capacity substantially larger than 0.5 BCF per day. It's actually scoped out to handle 1.6 BCF per day. So the 250
MCF. That wouldn't comply with the AGEA.
But I think that's what we discussed in the earlier opinion, Senator, was that it's unclear whether AGEA is still in effect and whether the HB4 sponsors are limited to it.
Mr. Chairman, that certainly is your assertion. That certainly hasn't been what the sponsor presented to us. They are trying to be in compliance with the AGEA. So I just wanted to clarify that the numbers you're using now are starting to interject your scenarios versus just a true comparison to HB4. I just want to follow you.
Certainly, Senator. Thank you for that clarification.
I just want to make sure that that's right. Because I had heard in previous testimony that Alaska was moving or would use for in-state about 200 to 250. I have it in my notes somewhere. So in my mind, I was just trying to true up that would be 50% of the volume under HB4's proposal. But you've got your 40-inch and 8-inch pipe
in there now, right?
Thank you, Senator. So 10% would be the three-train project out of Valdez with a 42-inch or a 48-inch pipe.
Thanks. Could you just point out if there's any other where you're using the different size pipe so that I understand it? And the only reason I caught that there is because I knew what the 250 was.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to help answer the question a little bit. Actually, HB4 does not designate any particular size pipe. There's no limitation, and it could be a 48-inch pipe in House Bill 4 itself. There's no limitation in that legislation.
Mr. Walker, I totally understand that, but HB 4 presents a scenario under a GIA, and a GIA limits to 0.5 BCF, correct? And that's all the testimony that we've heard. So I'm just trying to make sure I understand what you're presenting to us, and if there's if we see a separation where you're moving on a larger volume back to the 2.7 that you're proposing in a larger diameter pipe. I just want to know that. And sure. The only reason I caught this particular one was because I knew what Alaska needed in volume from a previous discussion. I just want to know where we're moving in between pipes.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Said I had planned on going over that when I got to this point, so let's get to that point. And that point is contract versus common carriage. And it's in our interest to have common carriage for in-state volumes. I think everyone will agree to that. The reason you might not do it is because it will help the financing in certain situations. So currently, oil pipelines throughout America, including TAPS and the upstream pipelines between the fields of the North Slope, are all common carriers. That's because in America, oil pipelines are common carriers. And those pipelines are financed all the time. But what you don't get is you don't get the advantages of having the shipper being part of the financing. So I like to think of it like a mall. When you're a contract carrier, so when you're a common carrier and you're financing a mall, the developer goes to the lender and he says, here's my plan for a mall, lend me money. And the lender looks at the creditworthiness of the project developer and he says, yes or no, based on the creditworthiness of the project developer. The analogy for a contract carrier would be a mall where you have long-term leases in your anchor stores. So then the lender goes to the bank, and the borrower goes to the bank, and he says, I have a mall, I want to finance it, but in addition to my promise to pay back the loan, I also have, you know, JCPenney's and Macy's and these anchor stores, and they've committed to me for a lease for 20 years. So you not only have my creditworthiness as the project developer, but you also have the creditworthiness of these anchor tenants who are promising to pay X amount per year. So the advantages of contract carrier status is that you get not only the creditworthiness of the borrower, the project developer, but you get the creditworthiness of the shipper, who is basically a person entering into the lease for the capacity. Contract carriage certainly helps financing when you're an independent pipeline, because the person that owns the pipeline is different than the person that is shipping on the pipeline. So you're basically getting two different guarantees. When you have an affiliated pipeline, like you do, for instance, with TAPS, or you probably will ultimately have in Alaska with the North Slope pipeline, the value of the contract carriage guarantee is substantially reduced. And it's reduced because BP PLC is going to, if they are the project developer, the pipeline owner, their corporate parent, BP PLC, is going to guarantee the debt. On the other hand, if BP PLC is the owner and the shipper, and they enter into shipping commitments, it's going to be BP PLC, the parent company, that also provides the guarantee on the firm transportation contracts. So for instance, when TAPS was built, BP Pipelines did not enter into the financing by itself. It had the BP corporate parent obviously guarantee the debt. So whether the guarantee comes through the pipeline company or comes through the shipping company is of less importance in an affiliated situation than an independent situation. So I think when we look at contract carriage and we look at whether or not we really want it for the state of Alaska, we're talking about the situation where you have an independent pipeline company. And what I would like to analogize it to is the mall again, and I would just put it like this. The pipeline owner, when he goes to the bondholders or when he goes to the lenders to issue bonds, he does in fact want to have these firm transportation commitments because it puts the pipeline owner's credit back by BP, Exxon, and Conoco, and that's a good thing. But there's no reason not to leave some small volume of the pipeline that doesn't have these firm transformation commitments in order to guarantee in-state access. So you can do it by a percentage or you can do it by an absolute number. But in my view, it is certainly in Alaska's interest to leave some level of the capacity on an in-state line, all of it even, to be common carriage. It would be like the developer going to the mall, the developer on the mall going to the bank and saying, I've got JCPenney's and Macy's and all the anchor stores bank, but I don't have the Foot Locker signed up yet. You know, it's not going to be absolutely critical for the financing to have every single tenant in place to get that mall financed. What's critical is the key shippers. So I would suggest that common carriage is in our interests for in-state deliveries to ensure access, and that the we certainly look at providing at least a percentage of the capacity as common carriage, as current law suggests.
Question, Senator Faircloth?
Just a quick one. In the lower 48 markets or other areas, are they typically common carriers or contract carriers?
In the lower 48 anymore, gas pipelines are typically contract carriers, and oil pipelines are always common carriers.
So why is it a better deal when we can get better financing for Alaska to go to a common carrier? I understand the issue of access. So Alaska is certainly on that line, but if you just have any comments there.
I do. I think the reasons are the ones that Alaska law was changed to have common carriage in state originally, and that's just that if you can finance the project with a little bit of common carriage, you ensure access in the future from non-Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson fields. It allows independents at a later date to ensure that if they develop gas, they can get their product to market.
Okay, go ahead.
And you don't believe that the recourse fee that would be established by RCA protects that?
I don't, because I think what we'll get to in the next slide or two is that having the recourse fee doesn't do you a lot of good when there's no capacity on the pipeline and you don't have rolled-in rates.
Actually, maybe we should hold off on the questions a little bit, because I do want you to get through your slides, and then we can ask whatever questions we may have. Okay. Go ahead.
So the next slide, I wanted to explain the difference between incremental and rolling rates and how they're treated at FERC level versus how they're treated in SB4. So we are a little tight on time, so I'm going to direct you to specifically two exhibits. Let's see if I have it here. Exhibit 9 and Exhibit 10. Exhibit 9 was a memo that was written for the state by Don Shepler. And from the GIA days, a lot of you remember Don. And he explained the danger of having incremental rates on Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. And specifically, and this is an off-slope gas pipeline. And specifically, what he explained was that you don't want to be in a situation where the initial shippers get one rate, and when shippers down the line come in and want expansion capacity, that they have to pay for all of the expansion. Because effectively what it does is it means that when you have maxed out the compressionable expansion on your pipeline and you have to start going to looping, that is, you have to start actually adding pipe to get compression, it makes that incremental cost of expansion very, very, very expensive. It means that independents will basically have to incur the cost of almost a new pipeline to get incremental expansion above what you can get with compression. And of all the things I'm going to say here today that is inconsistent with HB4 and what FERC said needs to happen in Alaska, I would ask you to focus on this one, because FERC found it was incredibly important for development of our basin that there be a presumption for rolled-in rates. That if you have a new explorer on the North Slope a few years from now who finds gas, that he be able to access transportation, both in terms of capacity and rates, on parity with existing shippers. And what HB4 does is HB4 goes to incremental rates. It specifically doesn't allow the rolled-in rate to exceed the maximum negotiated rate. So I'll skip over the next slide because it's sort of detail. But I do encourage you to read Mr. Shepler's memo, as well as the PowerPoint presentation that was part of the AGEA work, where they were discussing the need to have rolled-in rates for purposes of AGEA and why. And it was basically what I've said here, is that if you don't have rolled-in rates, you're going to freeze out exploration of the basin when you get beyond your compression capacity. Okay. So the final large topic I'm going to address on here is just and reasonable rates. And just and reasonable rates are, of course, in comparison to negotiated rates. Under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission precedents, as well as current RCA law, rates on oil pipelines or gas pipelines have to be just and reasonable, with an exception or two that we'll talk about in a minute. And just and reasonable means the rate has to be based on providing the actual cost of service, plus an allowed rate of return. Just and reasonable rates are currently the law in Alaska. For oil and gas pipelines, they are the law for oil pipelines in the lower 48, and they are the law for gas pipelines in the lower 48, except before FERC, starting in 1996, as amended in 2003, you're allowed to file a negotiated tariff on gas pipelines within certain limitations and definitions. The problem with the HB4 proposal, as I see it, is it has a recourse rate, and the recourse rate is a just and reasonable rate. But Alaska is truly unique in that demonstrated history is in Alaska that shippers want high rates. And I know this is entirely counterintuitive, and when you first hear it, you're going to say, that's crazy. Why in the world would the initial shippers on TAPS want high rates? Why in the world would the initial shippers on a gas pipeline want high rates? And it comes to what happens. What is the practical consequence when you're an integrated shipper owner? When you're an integrated shipper owner, the tariff is not an economic cost to you. It is a pocket-to-pocket transfer. Instead, your true cost of service is the actual money you spend as an owner shipping your affiliated product. So I'm going to ask you to turn to page Exhibit 11, and I'll just point it out, and I'll let you read it on your own time in the handout. This is a BP Pipelines memo from 1977. And what this memo explains is it explains why, if you're an affiliated shipper owner in the state of Alaska, you want to file, quote, the highest possible tariff. And it all comes back to having a high tariff allows you to control the basin, and more importantly, it reduces the taxable value of your oil or your gas for purposes of production taxes and royalty payments. The higher your tariff, the less you pay in taxes and royalty. Because of that, the North Slope producers on TAPS have, since inception of TAPS, adopted a highest possible tariff strategy. They will do so again on Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline, if it's integrated. So these aren't just my words. The 2004 LBNA memo that I've attached, that was Senators Terrio and Representative Samuels, discusses this in detail. The RCA has discussed it in detail. FERC has discussed it in detail. Bill and I finished a case before the Honorable Judge Gleason of the Superior Court on the taxable value of TAPS. She discusses it in detail. And it's because the integrated shipper owner, BP, Conoco, and Exxon primarily, because they own the reserves and Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, it's because they want a high tariff that I'm very concerned about the provisions in HB4. The recourse tariff protects an independent shipper from a high negotiated rate, because they can always go to the recourse tariff. What it does not do is it does not protect the state from an artificially high negotiated rate that does not reflect actual cost of service. So it's two sides of the coin. We want to ensure as Alaskans two things. We want to ensure that, well, a number of things we want to ensure, but in this particular context, two. We want to ensure that if independents can gain access to the pipeline, that they can do so at just and reasonable rates. We also want to ensure that the initial shippers cannot enter into rate agreements that are higher than just and reasonable rates for purposes of reducing the taxable value of their product as it goes to market. And that's where I'm extremely concerned about the negotiated rate provisions of HB4. It allows a contract to be negotiated by the state on an individual shipper basis at rates higher than just and reasonable. And one of the things that I think the history of TAPS teaches us is that the state is not very good at negotiating rate contracts with the North Slope producers. In 1985, the state of Alaska, after about 5 years of what was then some of the most expensive litigation in the history of America, entered into the TAPS settlement agreement. The TAPS settlement agreement was an agreement entered into and accepted by FERC and the RCA, in which the state of Alaska allowed tariffs on the Trans-Alaska pipeline system that were other than just and reasonable. It was an alternative rate methodology. The TSM was in place from 1985 to 2000 for the RCA, and about 1985 to, I think, about 2005 before FERC. ultimately FERC threw out the TSM, as did the RCA. Between 1985 and 1997 and 1997 dollars, court has recently found that the TSM cost the state over just and reasonable rates $13.5 billion. We're talking the magnitudes of SB 21, $1 billion kind of a thing a year for oil, For gas, because the relative transportation price is a higher percentage of the value than it is for oil, at least now, these numbers could look even bigger if you end up with tariffs that are higher than just and reasonable rates. So currently under Alaska law,
Mr. Richards, I am going to have to ask you to speed it up a little bit.
Okay, thank you. We've exceeded our time frame,
but please continue. I want you to finish your presentation.
Thank you, Senator. Well, this slide can be summed up pretty quickly. Alaska law currently provides and requires just and reasonable rates. HB 4, for reasons that I don't really understand, wants to go to a negotiated rate system. And I'm going to suggest to you that that's not in the state of Alaska's best interest, that we should stick to the just and reasonable rate requirements currently exist in state law for interstate shipments. History in the state of Alaska shows if we don't do so, the tariff and netback will be gamed, and it will cost us billions of dollars. Pre-subscription agreements. What I tried to do here is just, I went through Order 2005, and Order 2005 is one of the exhibits in your packet. In Order 2005 was where FERC went through and explained the reason that it set the limitations it did on open seasons for Alaska. So on the right we have Order 2005 and the amendment to 2005A, and then we have HB 4. And pre-subscription agreements are where the initial shippers sort of agree to rates in advance of the open season. And what FERC said is, you know, we recognize the competitive dangers in Alaska, but we're still going to allow pre-subscription agreements. But unlike the way we treat other pre-subscription agreements in the lower 48, we're going to put on a bunch of protections. They, for instance, require that all pre-subscription agreements become public in full within 10 days of being entered into. They also provide, if you're a shipper and somebody else enters into a pre-subscription agreement on Alaska Gas Pipeline, every other shipper can choose the terms of that agreement. And then I talked about the late entry provisions and the prorating of the pre-subscription capacity to allow open season capacity access. So in the last point is just the different regulatory treatment for rates under HB 4 than exists under current law, and some of the variances between when FERC allows negotiated rates and what HB 4 proposes. HB 4 has much less oversight over non-just and reasonable rates, the negotiated rates, than FERC has. So I'm getting to the end here.
Okay. I'm sure there'll be some questions, so yeah, if you could just go through.
So when we look at HB 4, and I struggle with why we're so there's the issue that Senator Fairclough brought up, which is if AGIA applies and is still in effect, and that question is open under alleged counsel opinion. But if it applies and is still in effect, then the idea was to build a small diameter line, not to be out of compliance with AGIA. The point I want to make with this slide is that if we don't have to build a small diameter pipeline, we do not want to. And the relative incremental costs of putting in a larger pipe are not that high. And the AGDC cost estimates, as a litigator, I litigate pipeline cost estimates for a good chunk of my living. And it's kind of an interesting thing to do, but it's one of the things I do. And part of litigating cost estimates is that you build an expert team, you get the other guy's pipeline cost estimate, you go through it, and it doesn't take very long to figure out where the cost estimate's right, where it's wrong, where they're short, what they've left out, what they put in too much. And with review is vetting. So I was never able to find the AGDC cost estimate in a public forum in a public manner that I could review it. Instead, all I got was pretty high-level summaries off PowerPoint presentations and some more detailed information in some of the materials online, still at a roll-up level. We've provided a disk in front of each of you. And on that disk is two cost estimates that Alyeska has recently submitted to the Department of Revenue. And it's a cost estimate to replace taps with a 30-inch pipeline and replace taps with a 48-inch pipeline. And I can't go into the AGDC estimate and rip out their line and put in a larger diameter because we don't have access to it. But what I do have is a comparison that is only a few months old of a crude oil line. It's not a gas pipeline. There are differences, no vertical supports, compression rather than pump stations. I removed the VMT. But if you were to rebuild taps today, according to Alyeska, a 30-inch pipe would cost you $8.9 billion and a 48-inch pipe would cost you $9.7 billion. And that's reported after owner's costs and engineering. So I'm not suggesting that you should give any weight to the absolute values. What I'm suggesting is, at least according to Alyeska's work, the difference between a small pipe and a big pipe isn't that much. It's not a critical cost driver for this project. So let's not put in a small pipe. And by the way, the cost estimating team that did the work on the discs you have was Stantec, Michaels, Michael Baker, Price Gregory, and Alyeska. AGDC used for their cost estimating team Michael Baker, Price Gregory, Ward Whitmer, Larkspur, and Doyon Emerald. So you had a lot of the same guys doing both cost estimates. In fact, I deposed a number of them with Michaels and Michael Baker. I'm sorry, with Michael Baker and Price Gregory. So here's the point of providing you 2,000-page cost studies, one on a 30-inch taps and one on a 48-inch taps. I guess the first point is that why don't we have AGDC's cost estimates in public? They're a government corporation. If Alyeska can produce public versions of these kinds of cost studies for tax purposes, AGDC as a public entity could certainly produce very detailed versions that protect confidential information. The second point is that the pipe isn't the cost driver. Or it's a cost driver, but it's not the critical cost driver. But with a small pipeline, you're capacity constrained. So for a little bit more money, 10 or 20% more, you know, I don't know, I don't have a cost estimate. But for a relatively small amount of additional money, you can put in a big pipe, and you can have a big pipeline in the future. So certainly the move to AGDC of going to a 36-inch pipe, you know, they're 12 inches away from where they need to be, in my view. So that's a good start. But we want to design a pipeline for a little bit extra money that has the expandable capacity without looping to allow our basin to fully develop and grow.
All right, let's wrap her up, Mr. Richards.
Last slide.
Okay.
So concluding slide, mostly focusing on regulatory issues. And this is just a very rapid summary. Under HB4, you're putting together a pipeline proposal that likely will not have FERC jurisdiction. However, RCA is disempowered to exercise the type of jurisdiction it has exercised under Alaska law in the past or is currently empowered to exercise. You don't have in-state common carriage. You have incremental rather than rolled-in rates. And you have negotiated rates that are not just and reasonable that will allow a duplication of the netback gaming and the highest possible tariff strategy that's been in place for years on TAPS. So I would strongly suggest that you not change the existing regulatory structure via HB4 without a lot more thorough vetting and analysis of what changing the regulatory structure of this pipeline to uniquely regulate it, what that is going to do.
All right, Mr. Chairman,
just in wrap up, I going through this, I realize I failed to mention my or include a slide about the situation in Fairbanks, the trucking. I know that's a big issue. Mr. Richards and I spent a lot of time creating the first model on the trucking, working with Golden Valley and Fairbanks Natural Gas and putting the Port Authority. That's critical. And you know, if you took away the debt of that, you'd have gas in Fairbanks at about $6. And so if we look at a $400 million being expended under House Bill 4 for a third open season versus a debt on bringing gas to Fairbanks, you gas to Fairbanks for $6, you have it all over the state when you can bring it to a hub like Fairbanks at that price. Secondly, overriding concern on the House before is a lot of the hard-fought must-haves under AGEA, must-haves for Alaska that we had to have are being stripped down under House Bill 4. They talk about this, the two being blended together. It would be very definitely not in Alaska's best interest if that happened, that the big line went over to the structure, because those were, we spent weeks and months, many in this room did as well, up in the Terry Miller Auditorium, going through all that on the must-haves for Alaska under AGEA. And then the last thing, it's not just the pipe size, it's really the wall thickness, it's the pressure you can do to bring down those valuable liquids and for value added throughout the state, and for the value of the LNG piece as well. So it's not just tangled up on whose pipe is bigger or 6 inches bigger. It's really the tensile strength, the wall thickness, and how much pressure you can put onto that pipe. So anyway, we thank you very much. I know you're really rushed this time of year, and I know this was a big challenge for you to find time for this presentation. We will remain obviously in the room and in Juneau to be able to answer any other questions that come up after this presentation. And again, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, very much for your time today. And we do have the additional studies that we talked about as far as intake gas, etc. Happy to make those available as well.
And I also thank you for your time. I know it's precious.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony today. And it is good that you're going to stay around. I'm not sure where we're going to go. I do want to let the sponsors have some comments as well. And then I think, do we have a conference committee at 5:30?
Yes.
Okay. We may take a break at 5:30 and then maybe come back at 6. We'll see how the committee's feeling and hear from the RCA folks too. I think we mentioned RCA here quite a bit. So anyway, thank you very much for your testimony. And I think what we'll do is we'll let the sponsors now give their rebuttal, I guess. And then if there's some questions, perhaps we could call you back up after that if there's questions for you or you're going to be around Juneau, it sounds like, for the next couple of days.
Do we have briefities?
Sure. Yep. Briefities. All right, we're back. Okay, we're trying to be flexible these days. We do have the Mr. Gruing here. Is that right, Gruing?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's Stuart Gehring.
Stuart Gehring. Okay, and Angela, are you Angela? No.
No, Corey Mills, Department of Law.
Okay, great. Okay, good. These folks are the experts, I guess. Is that expert fair on RCA?
Stuart, definitely.
Stuart is, okay. And
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, I'm the Assistant Attorney General assigned to represent and advise the RCA. And I'm here today for basically as a resource to the committee as part of the Department of Law. The RCA has had an opportunity through a public meeting process to speak to the bill, and I think you've probably been supplied with a copy of the transcript of their public meeting. So I'm basically here as a legal resource for you today.
Great. I appreciate that. And I understand you have to leave tonight to be back in Anchorage in the morning. So I wanted to give the committee an opportunity to ask any RCA-related questions. And then we will take a break at 5:30. We'll have a conference committee in here. And we'll try to come back then at 6. We'll follow up with questions for Mr. Walker, Mr. Richards. Some of the members had indicated they had some questions. So we'll do that, and then right after that, then we'll hear from the sponsors of the bill. Okay, do you have any comments on the presentation you heard, or any comments about HB4 in general that you'd like to start out with?
Mr. Chairman, I think I prefer to take the questions that the committee has. I don't have any specific remarks to make at this point.
Okay, very good. Senator Fairclough.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Has Alaska ever had a gas pipeline that RCA is monitoring? Do you monitor pipelines now inside of Alaska, in STARS pipelines, or?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair. The RCA regulates a number of natural gas pipelines right now. They are economically regulated. They, under S-4206, the Pipeline Act, that includes a number in Cook Inlet as well as several on the North Slope.
Go ahead, Senator Faircloth.
Are they common carriage or are they contract carriage?
Senator Faircloth, the chair, all of the natural gas pipelines in the state today are common carriers. I will note, however, that AS-4206 was amended several years ago to allow for some contract carriage-like provisions, and that those provisions are to allow for firm service and interruptible service, which are two of the distinguishing factors of contract carriage. And there is one pipeline in the state that operates with both firm and interruptible service.
Additional questions? Okay, so it's my understanding that the proposed House Bill 4 pipeline ASAP would fall under RCA and not FERC. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is our understanding as well, as the project is currently specified and with the current project plan, I guess is the best way to put it. The July 2011 plan with the update.
Okay, and then would it be RCA's responsibility to make sure that the smaller independents have access to the pipeline, or how would that work? Who would oversee that?
Mr. Chair, if I might ask you to clarify, are you referring to under existing law or under House Bill 4?
Under House Bill 4.
Under House Bill 4, access to the pipeline capacity would be through the open season process that's specified in S-4208-300, I believe it is. And that process would be overseen by the RCA under House Bill 4.
Okay.
If you're looking at the bill in version /I, that would start on page 40.
Okay, very good. And then, of course, you oversee the tariffs. And go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the concept of a recourse tariff is contained in House Bill 4, and the RCA has a certain amount of responsibility for reviewing the recourse tariff under the proposed law. It's not identical to the FERC practice, but I don't believe it was the sponsor's intention to duplicate FERC practice.
Okay, very good. Additional questions? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you agree with the presentation or the previous presenters that if you do have an export line that goes to 48-inch, that you do not have to be under FERC supervision?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I did not have access to that presentation before today, and so I don't know the basis for that statement, so I don't think at this point I'm able to take a position on that.
I can continue, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, please do.
Can a gas line be both a common carrier as well as a contract carrier?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I think it's possible for capacity to be reserved for common carriage and a contract carrier line. That's not necessarily something that I'm aware of having been done. However, under the Stranded Gas Act, which is at least in part embodied in our existing Pipeline Act, there is a provision which does reserve a certain amount of capacity in that line for in-state use. And there's a process for doing that, and effectively the RCA would certificate only a portion of that pipeline and not the whole pipeline. So conceptually what you're talking about I think is possible.
My real question has to do with how would the RCA react if you did have a split common and contract carrier line?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm not in a position to speak directly for the RCA, but I will tell you what they've said in the past, and that is that they're a creature of statute, and that so long as the legislature makes a clear specification of what they want them to do, that the RCA will do its best to implement what the policy decisions that the legislature makes.
My last question, sure. Mr. Chairman, has to do with our policymakers here, and we're trying to look and see what can provide or can get us out of this energy crisis that we're all in, especially out in rural Alaska. One of the big things that is a big factor to me is whether we can go ahead and provide some cheaper means of BTUs out to some of these places, either down in southeast or down in the coastal areas, down the river, down the road there as it comes through the off the rail belt. My question, what kind of problems are we not foreseeing related to RCA when you start dealing with LNG plants taking off the gas, taking off the liquids and shipping propane? What am I not thinking of?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that's a pretty open-ended question, and I guess I would start by saying that there are some jurisdictional limits that the RCA currently has. One of those is that any delivery of natural gas or petroleum products or something like that that are delivered by tank, truck, or similar conveyance are not within the RCA's jurisdiction. So to the extent that you might be delivering either liquids or liquefied gases or something like that using trucks, that might not be a public utility service, and so that might be outside the RCA's current jurisdiction.
And that would go the same for barging?
If it's going on tanks, I think that would probably fit within that exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Senator Olson, additional questions?
Oh, I just have some questions when the sponsors come back, that's all.
Okay. Yeah, I think what we'll do then is we'll take a break here. We have to set up the room for the 5:30 conference committee. The co-chair tells me that's not going to be a very long process. The committee hearing won't be long. So I would think we could probably, Senator Kelly, what, 15 minutes?
Maybe a little longer than that.
Okay. Why don't we plan on resuming at 6 o'clock? We'll bring back Mr. Richards, Mr. Walker, for any additional questions, and then after that, we'll hear from the sponsors' bill that will conclude our business for tonight. So, with that, we're at ease till 6.
Good evening. It is 6:03. If you're joining us off net, we're in the Senate Finance Room. With me this evening, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, welcome. Myself, Senator Fairclough. We're continuing on with Committee Substitute for Sponsor Substitute for House Bill 4 Finance. It's an act relating to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. We had some questions. Mr. Walker, could you return to the microphone? Committee members have some questions. We're also joined by Senator Bishop. Welcome, Senator Bishop. Just to confirm if we have people on off net, is Joe Dubler with the Alaska Gas Line Corporation there? Not yet. Do we have anyone back? We have Daryl Klepper and Ken Vassar online for questions, as well as Dave Hagen. Okay, just let me know if anyone else joins us. Mr. Walker, if you could introduce yourself for the record so that clerks have the names as we go forward, then we'll start with questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Walker, Walker Richards.
Thank you.
And I'm Craig Richards, also with Walker Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Are there questions from committee members on the presentation that we received earlier? Labeled City of Valdez presentation on the in-state gas line bill HB 4. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Walker. what would be the minimum size of the pipe? You've stated that it should be a thick-walled pipe to carry liquids, a high-pressure pipe. But what's the minimum size? Do you believe would be suitable for the concept that we're talking about?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. If the goal is just minimum size, just to move 2.7, is that the question? Do I understand what volume is?
It's a good question. 2.7, with the idea that later on we may increase the amount of the volume going through the pipe.
I believe that you know, I actually don't. I don't want to guess on those kinds of things because I usually talk to people at Bechtel, and they give me an answer right away, and I feel comfortable with it. So I don't want to guess at that, Senator Dunleavy. I can certainly get back to you with that tomorrow.
Okay.
Senator Dunleavy, if I might, Mr. Walker, do you have an export license or something that we can gauge any of the conversation that we're about to have on?
No, there is not, Madam Chair. There's no export license at this point. Is that the question? No, there's not.
I just wanted to, I know that a couple years ago that we had heard that there was a stale export license available, and I believe we got a letter in our packet, or I've seen a letter that FERC says that is not in existence, but that's what I was trying to check on. We don't have an export permit.
And I'd certainly like to explain that. What happened is that the Yukon Pacific Corporation parent company, CSX Corporation, chose to not continue the efforts in renewing it because every so many years they would renew it. So they chose not to. And so as a result of that, they withdrew that license. And similar to what on the ConocoPhillips license, it was not extended and renewed. And then the Port Authority had applied for one and was not granted one, is asked to reapply when certain deficiencies in the application were cured.
Right. So there, Senator Dunleavy, the only reason I was asking that is when we look at volume, if we look at in-state use, that's for 250, BCF versus Senator Dunleavy.
Does the venue to Tidewater matter? Does it matter if it's Valdez, Port McKenzie, or wherever, in the concept that you envision would work best for Alaska?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, it's not specific of where it needs to go. It needs to be a world-class project, export project, to match up with the world-class volume that's there and whatnot. So if that can, wherever that can be done, is there any one location, any of those three, Cook Inlet, certainly Nikiski, Point McKenzie, Port Valdez, Gravina, a point near Cordova was another one that was looked at some years ago. So it's not just for one location, it just should be of that magnitude, though.
It's the concept for export, the volume. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Are there other questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. One of the questions I have is that you've got an estimate of $8.8 billion to go ahead and produce or to go through with a smaller line and a $9.7 billion to go with a larger line. And since we're out of the Finance Committee, how close, what do you have a plus or minus on that to give us an idea as to how close you are with your estimates?
Do you mean the Alyeska oil line information I presented earlier?
Yes, you had a 30-inch pipe with 440,000 barrels per day, and then a 48-inch pipe, one for $8.9 billion and $9.7 billion.
Right. Thank you, Senator Olson. I'm sorry, for the clerks, could you identify yourself before you respond? Thank you.
Craig Richards, and Senator, through the chair, I apologize. Senator, through the chair, I'm not sure I fully understood your question, but I will point out with those Alyeska cost estimates, much like the way AGDC presents their cost estimates, they're after direct costs, with owner's costs, with management engineering, but before contingency, line fill, ad valorem tax during construction, and interest during construction. So that number is what you might call direct cost plus, is generally how in pipeline cost estimating you refer to it. It's not your full-in cost number. It's your cost number after owner's cost and engineering.
So
if we can continue on, how much money are we going to actually spend, plus or minus whatever, 30% or whatever it is, at least those are the numbers that I've been told, before we actually have revenue start to be generated from that line for the state of Alaska?
I'll let Mr. Walker answer.
Yeah. Senator Olson, through the chair, revenues would on a project. Now we're talking about an export project. I want to make that clarification. Revenues would start immediately because that's how the project would be financed. It would be project financed. It would be financed in the bond markets, and revenues would begin as soon as gas was flowing. So, when you have a large volume project, I can't speak to the AGDC concept because that's not my area of expertise. So I don't want to try to guess when that revenue would come to the state. But on a large volume project, it would be literally on day one, because that's how it would be structured financially, and that's how every project in the world is structured financially, so that the financing, it doesn't go forth unless it does make money on initially on day one.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Well, I've got it on one of your slides here. Well, you've got the numbers there, and I just want to know how close you are. 21.
Senator Olson, through the chair. So I understand the confusion. I obviously wasn't very clear. This is a cost estimate, not for a gas pipeline project. This is a cost estimate that Alyeska did if they were to rebuild the oil pipeline.
Oh, I see.
And the reason that I presented it was because we don't have an apples-to-apples AGDC small line to sort of the TransCanada GIA big line proposal because the cost estimates are reported at different levels. So instead, what I did is I presented what Alyeska says the difference would be between a 30 and a 48-inch oil pipeline if you were to rebuild it.
You're correct, and I stand corrected, Madam Chairman. I guess one of the concerns that I have is that, you know, Alaska's fraught with projects that are out there that have been built when we've been awash with money and the windfall profits have been coming in, and projects have gone ahead with disregard for some of the economic feasibility and some of these influences by parties that with vested interest in the project, and the lack of an arm's length type of a viability test that's there. And I was wondering, you know, how do we make sure we don't go down a lane or go down a pathway that with decreasing revenues and assuming the governor gets his way on Senate Bill 21, how do we make sure we don't get ourselves in trouble? Give me an idea on how this is different than, you know, some of the heated clean coal projects and the Susitna Dam that was there before and those other big energy issues that have come down over the years.
Mr. Walker.
Senator Olson, through the chair, you know, the difference in this in the concept with the LNG is you go out and you pre-sell it. In other words, if you don't have a long-term offtake, take-or-pay contracts, you know, with the market, with those 11 companies that were listed there, those are the world's largest. If you don't have those, you don't have the project doesn't happen. It's not where you go and build it and hope it happens. You know, it's a significant difference than because you have the customer signed up on a take-or-pay arrangement. You would never get the financing without that because, you know, the state's equity would be 20% equity. You would never get the market to go 80%. They'll look at the three things they look at. Actually, the two main things is are you going to find the gas? They've done some projects in Australia financing them without having found the gas. Are you going to find the gas? The second is they look at the strength of the market. Is the market a market that's been there for years, and they look at the coal gases and Tokyo Gas, Tokyo Electric, those kinds of companies. So that's what they evaluate, and if it doesn't pencil, they don't put their 80% money into the project. So it's not a build it and they'll come. It's not a build it into a trading hub someplace in a location that you live or die by the price of gas. Those prices are locked in for 30 years for life of the project. I mean, so you know what your income you're going to bring in on day one and on day 30 year, you'll know that on a project.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Williams, did you have a comment?
Senator Olson, through the chair. On HB4, I have a very specific recommendation on how not to get trapped with a project you don't want. Mm-hmm. And that's to follow FERC's model for the RCA. And FERC mandated that it was going to retain jurisdiction over design changes. So FERC said, Alaska Gas Pipeline Project, what we're going to do is we're going to retain the right to order you to increase the size of your pipe if we think you got customers for it. They also demanded rolled-in rates, which means after the pipeline gets built, if you have potential shippers that want to come in, they can expand at a competitive rate. So the surest way not to get stuck with a small pipeline is to leave the regulatory authorities with mandatory design change jurisdiction and to require rolled-in rates.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson, and I apologize, Mr. Richards. Are there other questions from committee members? I had a couple. Mr. Richards, you indicated that we should build a larger line, and that would cost somewhere between 10 and 20%. And so I didn't want to compare it to the numbers that you gave us off the oil pipeline. I went to our 30% cost or plus or minus off of the AGD line. And so that would be somewhere between $750 million to $1.5 billion of, you know, if we would just build it bigger. And so my question is, how would you think that we could finance that just to lay more pipe or put bigger pipe there?
Chairman, you would finance it, well, so if you built overcapacity, if that is the option you're talking about. You'd finance it the way you do whatever capacity you build. It just goes into tariff as a cost. Ideally, you wouldn't find yourself in that situation because you would line up the market participants who were going to use the capacity on the front end.
Mr. Richards, you were the one who said that during your testimony. That's why I was just trying to, you know, get the calculation out. If we had the gas commitments for a smaller line, at least I wrote down in my notes that you had suggested that we should just build it bigger, and I was trying to figure out then how Alaskans would finance that, and that means that they would be paying for it in their tariff. It would increase the cost of gas to Alaskans. I just was trying to see if that was playing out right, if I heard you correctly, that we should go forward one way or another with a larger pipe.
Chairman, so I think the answer I gave to Senator Olson was a little more nuanced than maybe a little faster talk in the presentation. And that particular nuance that I provided was leave the regulatory agency with the jurisdiction to mandate the design change. So let an impartial regulatory body decide whether or not it's economically justifiable to go with the larger pipe, and ensure that you have roll and rate provisions that allow late coming shippers to come in kind of at the last minute, like the FERC late bid provisions, to get that big pipe in at the last minute. And otherwise, the larger part would, in fact, fall upon the smaller volume shippers.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Kelly.
So just to make sure, so it's a larger high-pressure pipe, correct?
I believe that's the proposal under the APP.
So I just don't know how that works. For instance, in Fairbanks, if you have a high-pressure pipe, then you have to have a straddle tank, correct?
I'll let Mr.
To pull the gas off to run it into a utility system, correct?
Mr. Walker.
Yes, Senator Kelly, through the chair, that's correct. There would be.
Okay, so that's about $250 million. So the ratepayers are going to have to suffer that cost, and there's only about 20,000, I think, ratepayers in Fairbanks. I don't think they can afford that. Second of all, if you want to then pull off and go to, if you want to run some pipe off to rural areas or something like that, you're going to have to either run a pipe from the last place that you had a straddle plant, or you're going to have to build another straddle plant, in which case the ratepayers in rural Alaska or some mine somewhere are going to have to pay for the straddle plant or bear the cost in their rates of a straddle plant. So I'm not sure how we overcome that when what we have to do is we have to get gas to Alaskans, and if we have a high-pressure line, we can't. We can, but I mean, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to do it that way.
Mr. Walker.
Yeah, Senator Kelly, through the chair, good points. But the significant difference is with the high-pressure, high-volume line, the cost of the tariff, the cost of the gas is significantly lower. Significantly lower because you have more people sharing the cost of that, of transporting that. So I think that the trade-off is that you get the gas to that location at a much smaller volume. I mean, it's a much smaller price because you're looking at a tariff. The open season that the TransCanada had a pipeline tariff and a distance-sensitive rate. It was $1.74 from Prudhoe Bay to Tidewater. So the Fairbanks would be probably half of that. So you're just looking at a much smaller rate when you're looking at a larger volume, and it would help justify so the offtake costs associated with that. While AGEA had a minimum of 5 offtakes, that doesn't mean that's all that would be. Certainly would be more than that. So it's a economy of scale with a large volume. More people, you know, when I'm in Seoul, Korea, and I look at 11 million people in Seoul, if they were our customers, we would have a much, much, much lower tariff, much lower cost of gas in our state as a result of that.
Well, maybe. I mean, you sound like you know what you're talking about. I haven't heard a rebuttal on that other than what you just said, and it hasn't been proven out to me. Maybe we'll see if that's the case in the future. So you don't like HB4 much. Our problem is then what replaces it?
Senator Kelly, through the chair, what replaces it, I think that on the immediate, There needs to be something happening for Fairbanks in the interior and rural Alaska right away. I think the trucking is a good start. I think that has to happen with or without House Bill 4, because House Bill 4 clearly does not get done in time for that. But the concern is that the House Bill 4 just doesn't It doesn't solve either of our problems. It doesn't put any revenue into the state as a result of bringing large volumes off and having an export piece to it. So there's no revenues to the state from that, and it doesn't solve our short term as well. So it really kind of falls in between our two needs, and because of that, we're going out and potentially spending $10 billion, which we Alaskans would pay for every penny of that, because there's nobody outside of Alaska that would participate in that. So it's really it just doesn't get the job done. It misses the mark on the current crisis that we're in right now, and it misses the mark on the long term as oil continues to decline. So, I think everybody recognizes that, you know, the best way to put more oil in that pipeline is to have a gas line. So whichever you find up there, it's got a market, whatnot. So, House Bill 4 just doesn't get the job done. It is from a size wise, and the biggest concern, Senator, that I have with House Bill 4 is its ability to get it turned over to some third-party entity, perhaps one of the producers on the North Slope, who really, their mission isn't, you know, that's, they do a wonderful job, and we're lucky they're there, but that to turn that over to them by just four votes and give them a structure that really doesn't protect Alaskans, that's frightening.
Thank you for those comments. Mr. Walker, you've been passionate about a gas line for how many years?
Since 77.
I think that was the BP note that was in was 1977 that you referred to earlier, too. I appreciate your service to our state, to the city of Valdez, and your advocacy efforts. I think we're going to bring the sponsors to the table now. I do have one committee member that needs to leave shortly, so I'd like to the sponsors, or if it's just Representative Hawker, Speaker Chenault, if they could come up to try to provide some testimony before one of our committee members needs to leave. Senator Dunleavy.
Just a very quick question.
Please, go.
Sorry, through the chair. The AGIA issue is somehow part of the conversation. How would you deal with the, and your understanding of the AGIA contracts and the issue embedded within AGIA in terms of different types of pipes, different types of systems, how would you deal with the AGIA issue?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, deal with the AGIA issue having to do with House Bill 4 or just on a standalone? House Bill 4?
Yes.
I would call Tony Palmer. I'd start with him and say, Tony, do you think we're in violation? I'd want to know what their position is pretty easily. And they tend to answer fairly straight about what they feel about that. The issue was raised by the sponsors themselves, and good for them to take a look at it. They have one opinion that says, you know, either G has ended or we could be in violation. My estimate, I've looked at the G information, it looks like they may have spent maybe $100 million. TransCanada, if they're entitled to treble damages, you know, starts to get up there pretty high. And so I think that's something that you would want to know the answer to. And I would start with a discussion with TransCanada. And that's how I deal with it.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Any other questions from committee members?
No.
Speaker Chenault, Representative Hawker, if you join us at the table. If the committee is all right, I will let Representative Hawker and Speaker Chenault, I'm sure, go through a list of points that they may have made through the previous presentation. I know I certainly have questions that I have of the sponsors. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and then we're happy to take your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will begin here. Representative Mike Hawker, District 27, South Anchorage, and co-sponsor of House Bill 4 with Speaker Chenault. Madam Chair, members of the Finance Committee, sometimes it's hard to maintain decorum in this building when you're so incredibly frustrated about an incredibly, when there's been a high quality and a tremendous amount of work put into a piece of legislation, and then to find you have one small community in the state spending $1 million. What you just heard was part of a $1 million ad campaign to defeat House Bill 4. And I got to admit, I'm not a fancy lawyer. You know, I once upon a time was a pretty good accountant. Now I'm a legislator. My co-sponsor in this, I think he's got a high school education, and he's proud of it. But what we do know is we represent the people of the state of Alaska. And things we do know are that there is no gas pipeline. There has been no gas pipeline moving. We have seen failure upon failure upon failure. And that's why we brought forth first House Bill 369 and then House Bill 4. After House Bill 9 last year, and House Bill 4, of course, is a remake of that this year. You know, when you listen to the fancy lawyers, and I won't apologize for that, because quite frankly, what we heard from them is what they're trained to do, and they're paid to do. They are paid and trained to lead you to doubt and question everything we have said and to believe things that quite simply are not true. I sincerely offer to this committee that it is my opinion that their presentation you have just been given is, at best, a significant misrepresentation and factually misleading. I noticed a fair amount. I got to appreciate, I mean, I wish I could argue like that in front of a jury, but I've heard inflammatory rhetoric that I found actually quite offensive. We have brought this bill forward, and we'll continue to do everything we can with this committee to dispel all doubt, erase all questions, and answer every concern you may have raised. To be very honest with you, we didn't see this presentation until moments before you did, basically at the same time, so we have not had the opportunity to prepare a detailed or complete response to it. So what we would, and frankly, it's late at night, we also have a floor session coming. So I'd like both Representative Chenault and myself to give a very high-level response. We certainly make our staff, my staff in particular, who's been the lead person in working the technical details of this bill, available to this committee, especially been able to respond to a number of the issues that were raised on the regulatory sections. But as I try to flip through this report, I mean, like I say, I can, you know, hitting the highlights of this. You know, the first thing a good lawyer wants to do is put doubt in your mind, question on the credibility of the sponsors here. It starts out with talking about what HB 369 did and the representations that were made. Quite frankly, I didn't agree with. Speaker Chenault and I wrote that bill. I'd suggest that we have a little bit of an idea of what we intended to do with that bill, and that bill was about taking care of the state of Alaska. And should we have enough gas come together from this project to make it to be a market-based transaction where buyers and sellers can come together, and if there is a market offshore, it can be accommodated, but first and foremost, 369 and House Bill 4 are about getting Alaska's gas into the hands of Alaskans who need it. Those are people in Fairbanks who are paying exorbitantly high prices for liquid fuels right now. Those are folks in the Southern Rail Belt where we are literally scratching to find enough gas to keep our burners lit this winter. And once we have that backbone in place to allow the build-out of gas infrastructure across this state to benefit every community that we as a legislature can facilitate, help, reach out, and touch. We see these comments here about somehow we're going to have some other pipe, some mystical other pipe that doesn't exist is going to have all these benefits. There's no benefit that was presented here that House Bill 4 does not offer to the state of Alaska. We're hearing about some huge savings for Bethel. Bethel is not going to see a penny of savings from a pipeline project that you just heard at the end here doesn't exist. There are no permits. There is no project. There is nothing moving forward. House Bill 4 is actually moving a project forward, Madam Chairman, and there is nothing that was presented that we are not also working to do by getting gas from the North Slope across Alaska and being able to facilitate the development. Let's talk about Bethel briefly. Being able to look at doing something like helping get gas to the Donlin Creek Mine Project, who right now are moving forward on a project design plan to import LNG to make their project work. We can get gas to them. AGDC would have the authority to work with the communities, with the mine, to make sure there's enough gas to get energy further down the river. AGDC has these authorities. We have crafted it into it. We want it to be a flexible, we want it to be a responsive organization that is responsible to the people of the state of Alaska. This is not about one community spending $1 million to kill a bill that is supported by almost every other community across the state that we've worked with, from the North Slope Borough, the municipality of Anchorage, to Homer. I go through this presentation, Madam Chair, and I mean, like I say, we will be happy to debate each of these point by point. We're seeing presentations on projects that don't exist. We're seeing, again, projects that are non-comparable and attempting to create it as comparable. We're seeing claims in here that are technically questionable. I see claims in here that are supposedly a revelation of confidential information from an expression of interest that was held. I don't know that that information's been released by the people that held it. I'm not quite sure what to make of this, and especially I don't see anybody on there that has gas to ship. We get down to, you know, the real problems here is, one more time, what we as a legislature have an opportunity to do here is to move a legislation forward that is in the best interest of the state of Alaska. And let's not forget what HB 4 is all about in its totality. It's not just about one project, although it is based around a backbone project that has proved the viability of getting gas from the North Slope into the hands of Alaskans without violating the terms of AGEA. That was that second point the Sharp lawyers made. They cast doubt. They wanted you to doubt that we would not be in, that we would be violating AGEA, make you think that HB 4 somehow trespasses on AGEA and triggers those treble damages. I could not agree more, nor could the state's Department of Law, nor could the Department of Natural Resources, nor could the governor, nor could legislative legal, all of whom have helped us craft this legislation. I ask you to read the full legal opinion from Mr. Bullock, who is a good lawyer, working for the legislature, is raising all sides of the issue. But as we take the full body of and legal weight of what we have done inside this legislation, I think it's in no less than four, and by now it may be five places, we have absolute prohibitions against AGDC doing anything that would place us at risk of violating the terms of AGEA. It is simply disingenuous to continue to push forward, and we kept hearing there, well, we don't count AGEA. AGEA either doesn't exist or HB 4 is going to violate it, so let's talk about this new fantasy project. The project that doesn't exist. HB 4 is about a project that exists. We have that project on the table. We as legislators have the opportunity to make it happen. And you know, Madam Secretary, with apologies, it's Madam Chairman, in bringing forth HB 4, one of the key things that we set ourselves out to do was we are about negotiating solutions to Alaska's energy problems, not fighting over differences. We heard here today a fight over differences, differences we disagree strongly with. Madam Chairman, I'd ask you to remember that this bill has been crafted in concert with our staffs over 3 years. We've worked with the Department of Law. We've worked with the administration. We've worked with the RCA. We've worked with AGDC. We've worked with our communities. It is legislation that works. It is not the specter of a disaster that was presented to us. In fact, it is exactly the opposite. It's the greatest hope that Alaskans have right now of seeing a project go forward. So it is also, and our legislation is crafted to provide the state of Alaska a seat and the ability for AGDC to participate in any gas line project that actually comes to reality in this state. You know, there's only one other project that's got any legs, and that's AGEA. And the reason we have AGEA is because we, as a legislature a few years ago, authorized the signing of a contractual agreement with TransCanada, granting them exclusive rights to develop Alaska's gas. We've seen them make the start and try to get it to the lower 48. We've seen that start fail. We've seen them change direction, start moving the way we set up AGDC to go. They're at least looking in the same direction now, north to south.
Representative Parker, we have some people that need to go. I'm wondering if we could pause and try to provide Representative Chenault.
Apologies, ma'am.
No, you're fine. I understand that you're passionate in defending your bill, but I do have people who are wanting to have some other appointments. Representative Chenault, Mr. Speaker, do you have some comments for us on?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Representative Chenault, District 28, Kenai Peninsula. Madam Chairman, I'll try to keep it short. I didn't sleep at a Motel 6 last night or a Holiday Inn Express. I'm not a lawyer. My co-sponsor here stated, just for the record, that I do. I have a 12th grade education, Madam Chairman. I'm pretty damn proud of it. Madam Chairman, what you listened to today, I really can't describe. I actually walked out of the room a couple of times, because I think what you heard were people talking about their vision for a project that they wanted to see go forward at the expense of Alaska. Their project, if you want to call it a project, is the state of Alaska spending between $45 and $65 billion of their own money to build this fantasy pipeline that fixes all of the world's problems. I don't think that's what Alaskans see. Madam Chairman, this is from a slide presentation that was done in House Finance. Maybe this is something they didn't talk to you about. On this list, it starts out, and some of these names you may recognize. El Paso Pipeline, Yukon Pacific Corp, LNG Project Sponsor Group, Alaska Gas Line Port Authority, Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Madam Chairman, those are all pipelines with the same program that have all failed. The only one that's on this list, actually there's two. There is the AGEA Gas Line Inducement Act, and there's House Bill 4. Those are the only two pieces that might be moving. If my memory serves me correct, and I won't impugn anybody, but I believe that some people supported the AGEA process. And I don't hold them at fault for that, but it amazes me whenever that happens that I haven't ever figured out how you can be for it when you're against it. And so, Madam Chairman, I won't continue to go on, but as my sponsor or co-sponsor talked earlier, they try to set up this that we may be skirting AGEA. Madam Chairman, the governor believes in AGEA. He is continuing to work with the three major groups plus TransCanada on the possibility of a bigger line. The governor supports House Bill 4. He looks as if it's an opportunity for Alaska if this big line doesn't go. We've worked with his office, law, you name which state organization and department, and we've tried to answer every question, tried to take care of every concern that they have. They also stated we might just sell all our assets and just give them away to somebody. Madam Chairman, this sets up a state corporation that has two commissioners that work for the governor of this state. If any of you believe that a state corporation under the leadership of our administration would give away state assets for nothing, then maybe you don't want to vote for this bill. We think we put the safeguards and the backgrounds into this bill to allow this project to go forward. It's not a $7 or $8 or $10 billion cost to the state of Alaska. As others have stated, the cost of this project will be borne on their gas shipments through that line over a 30-year time. So, Madam Chairman, I'll cut it short. I know I have a floor session to go to, but we continue to find ways to kill projects in Alaska. The previous speakers before us spent an hour talking about FERC. Madam Chairman, they may have some great ideas, but every project they've been involved with in Alaska, other than maybe TAPS, there's not a jointed pipe in the ground. And so if we want to see change, something has to change. You know, the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And that's what we're doing whenever we allow some of the things to happen in this building that does happen. So, Madam Chairman, before I get myself in trouble, I would just say between the co-chair and myself, or the prime sponsor of the bill and myself, and certainly our very talented staff and the members of AGDC, I believe that we can answer questions that any of you have to give you the comfort in knowing that when you push the green button on this bill, hopefully, Ms. Madam Chairman, that you've made the right decision for Alaska. So with that, Madam Chairman, thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson, if you need to leave, I understand. I don't know if you want to take the questions today or not, but there were some questions raised. A legal opinion was referred to. I believe that Representative Hawker was referring to Mr. Bullock. And so I'm wondering if someone wants to, in a brief way, respond to the issues that were raised by Mr. Bullock and why we believe that AGIA is still valid, or whether that legal opinion calls into question the validity of AGIA at all, so that this committee should consider a larger pipeline. Senator Hoffman.
Brief at ease.
Back on the record at 6:45. We're going to get ready to adjourn for the evening. So, Ms. Delbridge, Mr. Speaker, Representative Hawker, there was also raised the issue about rolled-in rates. So if you could provide either comments tomorrow about rolled-in rates. There was an allegation that this is a fundamental rewrite of all state pipelines. So if we could have a brief comment on that. Other challenges to the bill that we heard today were no FERC jurisdiction and RCA being disempowered. I know that you'll, Ms. Delbridge, can handle all this. I just wanted to give the heads up before
Madam Chair, if I could ask, would you like us to be able to testify on the record for people that were watching this, or would you like us to simply submit written testimony?
It's my hope that you could submit it before the committee so that it would be on the record. It's just that the time is running short. I know that you need to get to the floor session. I believe the people who watched the first presentation should be allowed to hear the responses, but it will be up to Senator Meyer. I'm just trying to cover the highlights as I saw them, at least in my notes. We were talking about rolled-in rates.
There were questions about open and transparent costs.
The recourse rates, there was a statement that the recourse rates don't protect the state from an inflated price on the pipeline. There was some issue with the contract carrier aspect versus the common carrier that was alluded to that would protect Alaskans and those tariff rates better. The access was an issue, if you recall, in the earlier presentation. And I think I've said it already, but just RCA in general and what that oversight might look like. I'm so sorry that we're disjointed. We're all trying to accomplish a project that's important to Alaska. Thank you so much for being here. With that, it's 6:47, and we're adjourned.